Some feel he's the pivotal person who helped save England and defeat Nazi Germany. Yet much that has been written about him is fiction.
In two best-selling biographies, all the information on Stevenson's youth is fictitious. His parents' names are wrong. His date of birth is wrong. The school he was supposed to have graduated from did not exist.
In wartime, Churchill said, the truth was so precious it had to be surrounded by a bodyguard of lies. Bill Stevenson said, nothing deceives like a document.
He was not a writer, not a talker, but he was an activist, whether it was in business or intelligence.
Long before anybody else came up with it, he had this idea of one world trading and industrializing countries.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 7th of May, 2021. And it's just local elections and elections in Scotland and Wales. We're streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and self-censorship of information, sadly the norm in the UK today due to the collusion of the media managers. And if you too can restream us live or rebroadcast over the weekend, just let us know and we'll credit you here. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news and our election politics show is, as ever, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second part, we get away from the election and just look at the police for a minute and spy cops. After the leak that the special demonstration squad may just have been rebranded, we were telling you about last week, the story of the decade, along with Julian Assange, we go deeper into what exactly was going on with the spy cops hacking people's lives. Plus, the ivermectin conference. This is this antiviral drug which could do a lot, but which in many parts of the world is banned. And we'll be hearing quite a lot about that again this week. Heartfelt assessment from Bath-based, evidence-based medicine doctor, Dr. Tess Laurie. And also Dr. John Lee. He explains the A to Z of how Sage, Boris, the farmer cheerleader, Starmer, have all got it so horribly wrong. And two angles on the question. Do those who say voting is a waste of time have a point? First of all, a new documentary called Monopoly, Follow the Money, looking at all the connections, the financial connections, the investment banks, the pension funds, as to who owns our day-to-day brands and the services and goods that we buy every day. And also, former CIA Colonel John Stockwell on how the CIA control the media. And also how the CIA run their secret wars using the media as cover. And finally, conspiracy classics this week. Number 5, Christopher Booker on climate change. But first, Hartlepool, the Senedd, the various elections today. We have a listen to an interview with our very own mayor, just about at the moment, maybe not in 24 hours' time. Marvin Rees denying being a bully, but the evidence is there for all to see. Then there was also the equalities agenda. A 71-year-old Uxbridge Street preacher is arrested. Is that equality for you? And also we look at the Metro Mayor and the Police and Crime Commissioners around here. But I guess we're going to have to start, Martin, with Hartlepool, aren't we? That's the... I was actually a little bit shocked this morning to not wake up and find out that we didn't know what really had happened around the UK or in the Senedd or in the Scottish Parliament. And so many of these counts are being delayed. Why can't they all take place like the Hartlepool one overnight? They certainly used to.
Well, I suppose what's happened is that parliamentary elections, Scottish Parliament elections and Welsh Assembly elections have been given priority. And, you know, lesser tiers of a government have been given less priority.
Well, they haven't had any priority, have they? Because those counts could have been and should have been taking place overnight to make sure that the ballots aren't tampered with. That's what happens in most democracies.
Well, it depends. In actual fact, in India, an election can often take 3 or 4 months.
Did I say mocracies?
Well, I'm just saying that in actual fact, it varies around the world. And, you know, and of course, obviously, the excuse this time about changing the situation is because of all the COVID restrictions.
Well, there's no need to do that at all. What you do is you get an account to take place in a separate gym somewhere. Usually they're at schools. What I've heard is that the ballot boxes are sitting there and nobody apparently has access to them. Nobody can tamper with them. We are assured because there are three main locations around the city, both of them privatised schools, and I wonder who does the security in those privatised schools, whether it's Bristol City Council security or whether it's some sort of private mob looking at after those. And anyway, so tomorrow morning around about 11 a.m. we're going to see the mayoral election ballot boxes opened up. But surely you take my point, we shouldn't be sitting here for 36 hours with the ballot boxes stuck in a room somewhere where no one's actually counting them. It's just inviting fraud.
Well, it's potentially could cause problems, but it's, I don't see that it is. There's usually a post ballot opinion poll,
exit poll.
And I don't think there is this time, though. Well, there will be in most places, and if there's any difference between that exit poll and the count, that is a first sign of any kind.
Yeah, but
fraud.
If there's no exit poll, we won't know, will we? So, no. I would just have thought the obvious thing to do, and certainly the tradition in this country is you, as soon as the ballot boxes are, as soon as the ballot's closed, off the ballot boxes go to be the location where they're going to be counted. Obviously, if it's all COVID paranoia or even sensible COVID stuff as well, that there should be distancing between people. You can have, you know, people being sanitised, even the little ballots themselves being sanitised if you really want. But this is really just, it seems to me, an excuse to delay things. And that's why we have overnight counts in the first place, is to make sure that there isn't that window of opportunity for fraud to take place. So, you know, we shall see what happens with these results. And I suppose all we can do is just cross our fingers and hope that there isn't any fraud taking place in these quite long delays. But anyway, so Hartlepool, it's a big swing to Labour, Martin. Away from Labour to the Tories, isn't it?
Well, what happened is at the last...
Isn't it?
No, at the last election.
No, it's not a big swing.
No, really. It's not. The Labour Party vote is virtually the same as it was at the general election. What's happened is that the 10,000 people who voted for the Brexit Party, for Nigel Farage, haven't got Nigel Farage to vote for anymore, so they voted for Boris, or Johnson, or the Conservative Party, or whatever it is. So in actual fact, there isn't actually much of a change on the general election outcome. But under first past the post, they lost last time, and it's a lottery, and this time they won.
And so why was there a 16% swing against Labour then?
Well, that's because the 16% swing against Labour is not to do with an increase in the Tory vote. That's what we're talking about here. The Labour vote has continued to peel away, which suggests that Keir Starmer's attempts to woo back potential Tory voters in the north of England are not necessarily working. I think we'll have to look closer at the results.
Well, he hasn't really tried, has he?
Well, he has. He's tried to present himself as being patriotic, wrapped himself in the flag, all of this sort of stuff. And basically trying to present an image he's tried to present an image of the Labour Party.
Well, why did he put forward someone who Corbynism? Why did he put forward an anti-Brexit candidate there when clearly the area voted for Brexit?
Well, that's clearly silly. And the reason they did it is because he was the local.
He's arrogant.
If the guy had lost in Stockton on Tees, which is just down the road, but he had been the MP, and therefore what's happening now in terms of choosing who gets to stand for the Labour Party is this people who are loyal to the new leadership.
And it doesn't matter whether they stand much of a chance of winning, just so long as they're loyal to the leadership.
No, they're certainly not going to give people who've got a chance of winning.
It does imply.
It implies
that Starmer doesn't have a chance in winning, doesn't it?
Well, that's what some would say. I would say that he's basically just going nowhere. When we look at the overall pattern of votes after all these, they've all been counted. My suspicion is it will look very similar to the voting in the 2019 general election.
My suspicion is Labour are not going to do very well at all. We've already seen some results in and also I don't know if it's exit polls, but it's initial results in Wales. A Labour vote there looks to possibly be holding up. We shall see. But the idea of losing Hartlepool for the first time you know, is a disaster, isn't it, really?
No.
I think, isn't it something like, well, you don't see, how can you say it's not?
The Tory press see it as a disaster.
No, it's not the Tory press. It's common sense to say see it as a disaster. It is. You know, why field a candidate that's obviously going against the grain of the constituency?
Well, that's a clear tactical error. I wouldn't deny that. But I would suggest to you,
it's a deliberate tactical blunder.
It's not a deliberate tactical
blunder. But there must have been people in Hartlepool pointing this out to begin with, yes, and you just weren't listened to.
Yes, indeed. And the point is, we don't get to select our candidates. It's actually the party machine that selects the candidates, and we just have to suck it up.
Oh, the apparatchiks. Yeah. Oh, dear. This is the Blairos.
There is, in theory, some kind of input, but it's increasing. Don't forget that we were unable to remove any of the Blairite MPs during the Corbyn ascendancy because we weren't allowed to bring through a reselection rule. And therefore, we've ended up with loads of the people. I mean, basically, there is a kind of party within a party, which is the party structure of full-time MPs and councillors and organisers and so on. And there is a sort of democratic facade bolted onto that. And,
well, I agree with that. I
mean, it's actually a bit of a dog's breakfast.
Well, it is. I think you basically, but your party's being sabotaged by its apparatchiks. You know, the full-time party members who are just deciding who they would rather stand, rather than who stands the best chance of actually winning an election. So, I mean, this is bound to happen in a party where the people who are full-timers in the party are more arrogant than the members and the voters, and they seem to think that they can use the party for their own political ends rather than actually just try and win votes.
Well, they would argue, and I'm not one of them, that they are the professionals and they know how to win elections, and it's the party members like me who are the amateurs who don't realise what they've got to do if we're going to win. And I think when they do something like this, where they've basically what they've tried with has clearly failed, I mean, I don't think it's a disaster for the Labour Party. It's no change, really. But at the same time, they ought to have been making ground, but they're not. And that does raise questions about what Starmer's trying to do.
Well, Andy Burnham is on course for a landslide in Manchester as Starmer's party implodes. Apparently, Burnham set to buck the trend, according to insiders. Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham is on course to win a landslide in his bid for re-election, in stark contrast with the disaster unfolding in Labour across the country, according to Labour members on the scene. Labour campaigners in Manchester report they've never seen anything like the level of support Burnham has been receiving from local people in Manchester. The early word from the count has insiders using the word landslide. Burnham stood out by standing up to Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak when the policies punished Manchester workers and businesses during lockdown, and against the Tories' dithering and willful disregard for scientific advice on schools. And that is in stark contrast to Starmer's weakness, as they say it, on the squawk box as a Labour leader, despite facing a what they call murderous Tory regime. The public gets behind people who stand for something and stand up for it. Who'd have guessed? So what do you think about Burnham?
Well, I mean, in another world, he would have been the leader of the Labour Party instead of Starmer. But he basically went to become mayor of Manchester when Corbyn was in the ascendant, because he didn't get, you know, he couldn't basically, he didn't win against Corbyn.
Did he see himself as actually detracting from Corbyn if he was to try and sort of compete to be Barton?
Well, no, I think in actual fact he was being talked of as somebody to replace Corbyn, but he didn't manage to do it. And Corbyn, of course, couldn't be removed until he'd lost the election in 2019. So Burnham then absented himself up to Manchester. And if Starmer were to decide to withdraw, which I don't think he's going to, then Burnham would be one of the people you'd think of as being throwing their hat into the ring.
Let's have a look at Bristol now, though. And fascinating this morning to see the... I mean, this is with the incumbent Mayor Marvin Rees here standing, trying to get re-elected. And Tristan Cork at the Bristol Post this morning. Joanna Booth, she has been on this programme in the past. She quite smartly kept a copy of this tweet that she saw earlier on. And the tweet reads, and it was later deleted by Tristan Cork, it reads, "The irony of a Bristol mayoral candidate paying to have a wraparound website ad and advertorial questions and answers with nice questions while being too scared to do a single one-to-one interview with a Bristol Post journalist for the past 18 months. Well, Tristan was pointing finding out there that there are a whole load of journalists that wanted to do one-to-one interviews with Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees, but he wouldn't do them. And instead, what he's decided to do is an advertorial, which is a paid-for article, which says at the top of it, advertorial, where there's a whole load of softly bold questions, nice and easy, nothing nasty and difficult there, nothing to answer like, why have you completely got rid of the role of councillors and you put all power into your own hands through your two-city plan, or whatever it's called, is it? No, it's the one-city plan, that's right. And he's also... you know, under fire in lots of ways, particularly to do with breaking the law over not funding education for disabled children, things like that. None of those questions, of course, were asked in these advertorials. So Tristan Cork is pointing out that what he's trying to do here, Martin, is actually run an advertising campaign and running away from the journalistic questions.
Well, it's interesting strategy, isn't it? Not from Marvin's point of view. It's pretty much the sort of thing Trump did, where he basically tries to communicate directly with the people he wants to vote with him rather than talking via any intermediaries.
Yeah, but and Marvin doesn't do nothing like it, Martin, because Trump was doing direct live press conferences. Marvin doesn't do anything like that. He does cushy, cosy interviews with people he knows aren't going to ask him any difficult questions.
Well, that is a strategy.
More like Biden, actually.
Yeah, more like Biden. And you see, what's happening with the way politics is kind of developing and changing is that different strategies for trying to get elected
deteriorating.
You could say deteriorating
because
yeah.
It's becoming more like a kind of corporate press structure, isn't it? I mean, you can see why as well, because many of the people who are now working doing public relations in charge of whatever they are, corporate communications executive for Bristol City Council, these are people from private businesses who are used to selling washing powder, not running a civic organisation.
I think that's right, but I mean, on one side, we're told that politics has got to be professionalised and people have got to do it properly and not be amateurish. And then, of course, the downside of that is it just becomes like selling washing powder and nothing else. And, I personally think that's a poor decision on his part. He should have stuck to the basic stuff of talking to people, using whatever mechanisms he can communicate with. But we will see, when the ballots are counted, whether what he's doing has worked or failed.
Yeah, will his washing powder sell or not?
Well,
that's the question, isn't it?
That's right.
God almighty, that's where we've come to. Anyway, he's Director of Communications. He's little Alistair Campbell, although as far as I know, Kevin Slocum wasn't responsible for the death of Dr. David Kelly back in 2003. Kevin Slocum is Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees's Director of Communications, or whatever you want to call him, his spin chief. And he then retweeted Tristan Cork's Bristol Live tweet saying in a sort of wraparound thing that he'd done around Tristan Cork's retweet, quoted in fact, that's what they call it on Twitter. The irony, says Kevin Slocum, of a journalist criticising advertising spend in the company who pay his wages. Well, that's rather a sneaky little way of putting it, isn't it, Mr. Kevin Slocum? So you're saying, but actually he wasn't criticising that. He's saying that he should have done the interviews. Not that they shouldn't have spent the money on the ads, Martin.
Well, I'm a bit confused about what you're saying. Kevin Slocum isn't saying they should have done the interviews because he's...
No, Kevin Slocum is, I'll just quote him again, the irony of a journalist criticising advertising spend in the company who pay his wages. So he's saying that Tristan Cork is criticising the advertising spend. He's not. He's criticising Marvin Rees's failure to do the interviews.
Yes, and I think that's a fair point by the Bristol Post guy, because in actual fact, what they're basically saying there is we've paid for a full page advert in the Bristol Post. Therefore, we're the advertisers, and therefore your ultimate employers. Which, of course, is a pretty convoluted argument, whichever way you look at it, isn't it?
Yeah, but anyway, it seemed to work with Reach PLC, because I've heard on the grapevine today that Tristan was contacted and told to take the tweet down.
Well, there you are. So, in other words, what's happening is corporate control, journalists are being disciplined through corporate means.
And I'll tell you why
that's been going on a long time.
That wouldn't, yeah, well, it's the the editor of the Bristol Post and the manager of the Bristol Post see it more important to keep their advertising revenue coming in rather than to do good journalism. And so that says it all in many ways. So Somebody else, I'm not sure who they are, called Lawrence Fox. I think he's taking the mickey.
Lawrence Fox is running for mayor of London. He's a sort of right-wing cranky person.
But anyway, what he's done is he's retweeted all of this, and he's saying, I pay your salary, chum. You lot should learn how to say thank you. So the idea is that we, since the advertisers are the main people that pay for the Bristol Post, then the Bristol journalists should just say whatever the advertisers want.
Well, I mean, and we're being given a pretty... I mean, if the tweet's been taken down because the editor told him to take it down, then that pretty much shows you what the structure of power in the Bristol Post is.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that's 100% certain. That's just the rumours I've been picking up from other journalists around the city today. And fascinating, anyway, I think, the way these things operate. Now, one thing's for sure. The Mike Norton, who was the previous editor, who was sacked about 18 months ago after criticising the mayor, Marvin Rees. Well, he says he was just retired, but actually he was sacked. He would never have stood for this because he always backed his journalists against the advertisers. He was, because he'd been the editor of the Post for, I think, the last 15 years or so. This is the sort of thing that wouldn't have happened under the previous editor. But now we've got a different regime at the Bristol Post. That's the kind of thing that happens. So is it feasible for, the city establishment, you know, the merchant venturers, the people that own Bristol, to lean on the newspaper so much that they can get an editor sacked to clear the way for a nice, cushy election with loads of positive coverage?
Well, I think it pretty obviously is. I think what's interesting, though, and I'm not sure, you can fill me in on this, Tony, I believe that the BBC channel funds to the Bristol Post for local democracy coverage, don't they?
They certainly do, yeah.
So in other words, it's not just the advertisers who fund what they do. And if that's the case, they have a legal obligation to behave properly in terms of interviewing people, holding them to account and so forth, so on and so forth. That implies that they've got some kind of BBC rules on them.
Well, those reporters do, yeah. And they work for the Bristol Cable. They also work for, they work for Bristol Live, the Bristol Post, the print edition, and some of their stuff also appears on the BBC website. So these local democracy reporters, which there are several in the city, do an absolutely incredible job. And of course, it was Adam Postans, who's one of those LDRs, as we call them. He was bullied by the mayor and the cabinet at one of the cabinet meetings when they said to him, oh, is there a reporter in the room? And that was actually part of the meeting, you know, where of course Adam is sitting there and they're just, you know, really just having a dig at him and having a laugh at his expense. Not really very, in fact, goes against their own procedures on bullying. So that's, I think, you know, what's happened here is we've got, it's created a very negative attitude towards the mayor's office here in Bristol by journalists around the city who know much more than the general public do about the way that the city council operates in regards to public relations. But I suppose the biggest change, Martin, we've seen over the last 5 years since Marvin Rees became mayor is this whole massive change, which was called, it was called at the time, wasn't it, a couple of years ago, a power grab, where the committees that had previously been chaired and sat on by councillors, elected councillors, are now chaired and sat on by hand-picked people who are handpicked by the mayor himself. It's called the One City Plan, and things like transport, housing, these policy bodies are now just handpicked by the mayor. They're not made up of councillors at all. In fact, no councillors are on them at all whatsoever.
Well, that's because the Conservative Liberal coalition created these elected mayors and gave them virtually unlimited powers.
But why is a Labour mayor doing this? Surely, you know, it's the sort of thing you might expect from possibly a Lib Dem, although in this case not, because Caroline Gooch, the Lib Dem candidate, is very much against the whole role of mayor, she says. It's the sort of thing the Tories would do.
Well, it's the sort of thing anybody can do if they're in the position to do it. I mean, if you look at what Andy Burnham is doing in Manchester, and obviously we're just hearing that he may have been...
But what's the point of doing that? We've got a Labour majority on the City Council of councillors. Why would a Labour mayor sideline them and put, his establishment friends in those roles? Surely, as a Labour mayor, he should be making sure that his Labour councillors are doing those jobs, not a hand-picked bunch of city elite.
Well, when he first took over, if you remember, he inherited from George Ferguson, the previous mayor, an all-party cabinet, which included everybody.
Well, he said he was going to have an all-party cabinet.
Yes, so that's what happened. And then he got rid of the other parties, and then was dependent on the Labour Party. But of course, the rules are that he's not actually dependent on anybody. And if he'd wanted to, if Ferguson had wanted to, he could have ruled completely by appointing his own people. But because Ferguson didn't have a political party, he was an independent, he thought that he'd, you know, made more sense from his point of view to bring the political parties in. And that was quite an interesting idea. And at first I was rather opposed to it, but after a while I thought, well, this is an interesting way to do things. It's a bit makes Bristol a bit different. But of course the problem is with elected mayors is that once they are elected, they derive their mandate from the election, and therefore they can override other elected councillors, anybody else, and they can they can basically pack, especially the longer they're in, they can create a local authority in their own image. And I think that Marvin has pretty clearly flagged up that's the way he wants to do things. It'll be interesting to see whether he gets a mandate for it when they've counted the ballots.
Well, we've had quite a lot of people speaking out against the way that the mayor has been doing things, not least of which is Councillor Joe Sargent recently left, and there was another former Labour councillor also too. Her resignation statement has been played down by Mayor Marvin Rees, but it makes it absolutely clear that she believes that she was consistently bullied in her role, and she couldn't have timed it more to make more difficulty for the Labour administration, could she? She just resigned 6 weeks before these elections, Martin, making a public statement about bullying.
Well, that will be her political calculation of what she's doing and why she's doing it, and it may damage Marvin. And if it does, then that's something for him to take on board, isn't it?
Well, anyway, the Bristol Post columnist has been doing, his name's Neil Maggs, has been doing various interviews with the mayor candidates. And he, as far as I can tell, was the only one to actually broach this whole issue of bullying with the Labour mayor, Marvin Rees. And so I thought we'd have a listen now to that exchange as to whether Marvin Rees himself believes he was being bullied. Interestingly, this interview, when it went up, it got no acknowledgement from the City Council. They much prefer to retweet and Facebook their own advertorials they've paid for at the Bristol Post than anything like this. So that's why I thought it might well be worth a watch, because I could see no sign of it on the Mayor's official or any of the City Council Labour Party Twitter feeds or whatever. Fair play to Neil for actually asking these difficult questions. But anyway, here's Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees responding a couple of weeks ago to accusations about bullying, which are really, you know, if you put Bristol City Council bullying or Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees bullying into your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google, you'll see there's a whole load of stuff out there, including some pretty amazing institutional stuff to do with literally not allowing debates and discussions, him along with Marge Hickman deciding what the answers are going to be, and then telling the councillors, no, we're not going to be talking about that, we've already decided what we're doing.
Lib Dem candidate Caroline Gooch basically said the mayoral role attracts big egos, egoists. So are you an egoist?
Well, and what evidence did, I mean, what was the argument about that?
Well, it was just a statement. I think she was on Points West, and she said that she feels that the mayoral role attracts kind of alpha males, egoists. And I did ask her herself whether she felt she had that. Herself. And she said, I think the nature of the role, mayor, which is slightly different than councillor and slightly different than MP, and you have to have broad shoulders. You have to kind of be somebody who's prepared to give and take stuff, attracts egoists. That was the context. So are you an egoist?
Well, I don't think so. But I mean, I don't know what to say unless you're going to actually, you know, put a coherent argument together to build up to that.
Explain what you said. Oh, you mean Caroline herself? Yeah.
It's okay. A charge without an argument, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, well, you can add to it. You can still say whether you think you are or not, couldn't you?
Well, I don't think so. And I don't think that's the way people experienced me in the city over the last 20 years.
She wants to get rid of the position, obviously, and there has been, you know, kind of a fallout for yourself with a number of opposition councillors and parties, including some Labour councillors, accusing you of shutting down debate, not letting them have their say, even bullying. Are you a bully?
No, I'm not a bully. That's Neil, so let's have a look at the argument then, right?
Yeah.
So they don't like the mayoral model. So the question is, what's on offer? What's on offer?
Where is this coming from, this whole bullying thing? You know, you're a bully. They've said this has been said.
No, but again, if someone comes and says it, it's worth just cross-referencing with other people in the city. We, you know, pulling the city together in a way that we have since I've been elected as mayor would not be possible if we, in terms of opening up decision-making to our city partners, if we approached it in a way that wasn't okay. The youth work I've been involved in over the years, the city leadership program, I work in the voluntary sector. You know, I've got enough of a track record in the city. It's not too hard to go out and ask people if they think that this is the truth. Some of that is political gaming. Some of it is people who are sensitive when they're asked a question back. And what does happen if I'm asked a silly question, I will sometimes ask people why they've asked a silly question and they.
That's journalism, isn't it?
Yeah. But you know, I think that's okay. I actually, dare I say, the unwillingness to take questions now is one of the problems with our political debate. It becomes like a turkey shoot conversation rather than a genuine conversation. But if we go back to the point we made, one of the reasons of having a directly elected mayor is so that the people of the city can actually elect the political leader,
yeah, right,
for a period of time.
Yeah.
What the Liberal Democrat is actually asking for is to go to a leader model. So the question is, and I'll answer it because I know you don't want to answer it.
Yeah.
The political leader in a leader model, how are they chosen? Well, the councillors choose them, right? So the councillors with the members of the largest party go into a room.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There might be 30, 34 of them in a room and they vote for who their leader is going to be. So 18 people say choose their leader of that group. Then that group has its negotiations with the other councillors and then they come to an agreement and go to full council and the 70 councillors at full council then have a vote. And if they agree, that person becomes the leader. So where are the people of Bristol in that process of choosing the political leader of the city?
Well, the answer, of course, is that they vote for the party who they like the leader of, and then that leader might become the mayor, or actually be the leader of the council in the old system. But the trouble with the mayor system is there's only very few people who get to stand a chance of being mayor, and it's a bit like political leadership. It's quite easy for the establishment to make sure that each of the people standing is one of their poodles. In the party system, it's a bit more democratic. You're quite anti the mayor yourself, Martin.
Well, I'm not really in favour of the mayoral system, but I mean, obviously there are arguments in favour and against. The way Britain has traditionally been a parliamentary democracy with cabinet responsibility. So even the prime minister, in theory, is supposed to be primus inter pares. In other words, the cabinets make decisions. Now, in actual fact, that's long gone down the drain. And we're moving to a more US, I mean, the whole mayoral idea is a US idea. And don't forget Marvin has got an American wife and he's studied in the US.
Well, he was tapped up and scooped up by Harvard, sitting next to Alexei Navalny too. And he went on their World Fellows thing at Yale as well. So, you know, he's kind of a typical example of how the Americans want to do things here in Britain. But anyway, that interview was part of something called Bristol Unpacked with Neil Maggs. And there he was interviewing Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees, asking him about the bullying. I think quite, good and interesting. But anyway, so a few things brought up there. You were saying things like, it's political gaming. People are too sensitive. That's why they're saying bullying, because I'm not bullying them, but they're sensitive. And a lot of this seems to be criticism being just diverted and not taken on board.
Well, I mean, he was asked the question, are you a bully? And he answered, no, I'm not, which is what most people would do. And the question is, what are the specific allegations if it's going to stick? I mean, Priti Patel has been found guilty of bullying by the senior civil service. The guy was then sacked, was paid $350,000 of public money. But did she have to resign? No, she didn't. So, I mean, an allegation of bullying is a serious allegation, and therefore, you know, it's got to be seriously backed up. It can't just be, I think he's a bully. It's not enough, is it?
Well, that's not what's really taking place here, though, Martin. You know, we've got these very solid allegations by Joe Sargent, who's left the party as a result, you know, specific.
Well, okay,
stuff.
So that's a specific allegation, but she would have to substantiate that. I don't know what her allegations are, so she'd have to substantiate them, wouldn't she?
I'm afraid it's written in such small print. print, it's very difficult for me to read it, but I'm quite happy to do that if you want.
Well, I mean, we could go through what she's actually said, but I don't know what she said. And therefore, well,
we did cover it on a previous show.
I'm aware that she's not happy with, I mean, don't forget the fundamental problem here is that Marvin has total power. And lots of other people find that very difficult because they don't want him to have total power. And he has got total power because that's what the mayoral system does.
I mean,
if he's re-elected, he will then go, he will double down on this total power.
Well, so for example, one of the things that Joe Sargent says is that Marvin's enforcer amongst the Labour councillors is someone called Councillor Margaret Hickman. And she's, styles herself as Labour group leader. Of course, that used to be Helen Holland years ago before Marvin turned up, and she was completely sidelined, despite having never been elected. So,
Margaret was elected. She was my councillor.
No, not as elected as group leader. She's been appointed group leader by Marvin.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, do you see what I mean?
She's a manager.
There is this whole kind of cliquey, hand-picked thing rather than any kind of agreement. So,
you could argue, wasn't it?
Right when this all started, when George first arrived, back in 2012, wasn't it? That everyone was saying, well, this system could be a dictatorship, and this is the way it's going.
Yes.
It's like a chief executive of a company rather than the leader of a city.
Yes, well, he's not even answerable to the Labour group. I mean, when Ken Livingstone was running the GLC in the 1980s, some other guy was elected as the leader initially. The Labour Party had won the election. And then there was an internal coup in the Labour group, and Ken Livingstone was elected as the Labour leader of the Labour group and therefore leader of the GLC. That was his official title. But of course he couldn't do anything without the agreement of the Labour group, the Labour councillors. And that has usually been the model before this mayoral stuff was imported from the US by the Tories and the Liberals, when they came to power. And the real problem with any system like that is that if you give somebody the potential for total power, then they're likely to take it. Because there's no checks and balances in it, and there's a straightforward conflict of interest could turn up. You could have a mayor that doesn't have a majority of support in the council, and that is quite likely. We may well find ourselves in that situation here in Bristol when we come to count the ballots, which will give Mayor Marvin Rees total power, but in actual fact more councillors are opposed to him than are for him.
So even the count hasn't started yet. These ballot boxes are sitting there. Let's just hope they're being properly guarded up at the Oasis Academy, the City Academy and City Hall right now, waiting to be opened at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. So that's, 36 hours or so sitting around where they could be being tampered with, which I just think is totally ridiculous. And, no amount of COVID security can excuse it, really. These elections aren't, less and less secure the longer there is before you count them. But the only place I could really find where there's a... it's Ladbrokes, I'm afraid, Martin. We're going to have to look at to see who the pollsters are as to the most recent poll. They're putting Marvin Rees as the favourite. Second, would you like to guess? The Green.
I would have thought the Greens, yeah.
Yeah. Then, interestingly, they say the Conservatives, and they say that the Lib Dems' Caroline Gooch is fourth in line. Well, that's a terrible pity, because she's the only one that's actually standing to return Bristol to some sort of form of democracy. I think Alistair Watson, to be fair, for the Tories, is as well, but he doesn't really stand a chance.
Well, if the combined Liberal and Conservative vote is more than 50%, they could argue that they've got a case for returning to the previous setup. But I'm afraid, even though the mayoral system was smuggled in here by the previous governments, the turnout in the referendum to vote for having a mayor was pitiful, and it was only a tiny minority of that decided to have one. But we've now got one, they're there, they have the powers they have, and Marvin now, if he gets re-elected, will say that's his mandate, and then he will carry on doing centralising power in his own hands because that's what the system allows him to do.
Interestingly, or wrongly. I mean, interestingly as well, we've got two common purpose candidates as top one and two. This common purpose group, which is very closely associated with Business West, not only in some of the personnel, but also the physical location of their Southwest headquarters. And this Business West takes loads of public money, Martin, doesn't it? And they're involved in all sorts of partnerships and things. And they're sort of taking over in a way from local government, in that they get to make lots of decisions at places like the West of England Combined Authority, where we don't actually get very much democracy at all. So this is the problem I have, is that we've got a kind of common purpose establishment, a choice between number one and number two here.
Well, I mean, there's when you say they're common purpose candidates, you mean they've been on common purpose
purpose graduates.
Yes, they've been
on the course. Now, It's worth saying that the most creepy thing about common purpose is probably the way they profile people. So when you first turn up to be a common purpose graduate, you get a whole sort of interview, you know, or what did you do when you were a kid, and you know, what are your deepest fears and all this sort of thing. And I find it actually quite creepy and manipulative, and particularly the fact that the actual membership list of Common Purpose is totally opaque. We don't know. And the only reason I know is because I spoke to somebody who I can't name, but I totally trust, who was told by Sandy and someone else, by Marvin, that they're Common Purpose graduates. So that's the only reason I'm saying that here, which it's not, you know, 100% proof, but it's as close as you are able to get with these groups, because they will not tell you if they are or not. And certainly if someone like me asks them, who they know knows exactly what common purpose is.
Well, I think it's there are all sorts of groups which are attempting to influence political leadership, and common purpose is a sort of, you know, it's got a, you know, it's a very shady organization, as you know, and they basically are, you know, you can imagine that, you know, people like MI5 and MI6 are interested in who's going to be a candidate. Don't forget that some serving British Army general said that Corbyn can never be Prime Minister because we won't accept him. They have their views. And, of course, if you want to get anywhere in politics, you've got to get on the side of the people who can do your career some good, and that's part of the process of what goes on. You can see this happening to the Green Party in Germany, who are probably going to be the biggest party in the elections that are going to be held there, but they've become very, very establishment-oriented in order to get to that position. They're very much not hairy freak radicals anymore.
Okay, so trying to twist a little bit more the knife into the wound, Martin, over Hartlepool. Although actually I'm not, this is going back before the result of that was known. Larry Elliott in the Guardian newspaper this week was saying, until Labour Remainers properly accept Brexit, the party will be stuck in limbo. That's almost a headline that could have been written for you.
Well, I think the fact is that we're going to have Brexit. It's going to be a hard Brexit, and some parts of the country are going to feel okay about it. We'll see how Hartlepool feels in 5 years' time. And in any case, the Labour Party voted for the deal, because the alternative was no deal. So it's still causing bitterness, because don't forget, at the general election in 2019, 57% of people voted for parties who wanted a second referendum.
What about the Channel Islands, do you think?
The Channel Islands don't vote in our elections, Tony.
No, but when you're talking about the bitterness, that seems to be playing out there,
doesn't it? Yes, well, that's very interesting, isn't it? Because in actual fact, we're going to end up in a trade war with France, which is going to ruin loads of businesses on
you
both
think
sides.
So? No.
I think it's quite possible.
No, it's not, because it's in both sides' interests to trade. Of course it is, and everyone knows that.
No, but the deal that we've done, the EU are going to insist that the deal has been done, and that deal is now signed and ratified by the European Parliament.
Larry Elliott, I mean, you know, you can carry on this Remainiac line as long as you want, but Larry Elliott saying, look, Labour's duty now is to help improve people's lives, not to keep going on about an election that took place, or a referendum that took place, what's now 5 years ago, and just keep bellyaching about it.
No, what I would point out is this. At the 2019 general election, it won't be much different when we've counted the ballots today. The electorate, were offered, 57% of people voted for parties who wanted a second referendum. Because of the electoral system, which has been run by Eton College since the 18th century, 43% of the voters got everything they wanted, but 57% were shot out.
Okay, well, you keep saying that, but Jeremy Corbyn could almost certainly have won, couldn't he, if he'd have voted alongside, or if he'd had his policies alongside being pro-Brexit, and also had actually dealt with the fake anti-Semitism claims. He could have won that election under the first-past-the-post system. Yeah. It's people like you that have diverted the Labour Party into trying to, you know, carry on with the Remain campaign when the vote is already long gone. And also, I mean, it's not certainly not you been involved in the fake anti-Semitism claims, but Brexit was the key thing. And also here, we've proved again in Hartlepool, all these people in the Labour Party that still want to carry on being Remainers long after the vote are basically sinking the party without trace unless they change their way. That's what Larry Elliott's basically saying.
Well, Larry Elliott was in favour of Brexit, so that he would say that, wouldn't it?
It doesn't make any difference what he was in favour of before. No. And also, there is a large consensus, which you seem to have ignored in the country, which wants to go the way of the vote. Whatever the vote is, even the leavers, if it had gone Remain, many of those leavers would have gone, right, OK, it's Remain, now let's just put that behind us. But people like you just will not.
No, listen, in Northern Ireland and Scotland, this definitely isn't finished, or in Wales. And we'll see
We're in England, aren't we?
Yes, indeed, but and Hartlepool
Wales,
is in England.
Wales certainly is finished, actually.
No, it's not, because what's going to happen is Plaid Cymru want to go back into the EU.
Wales was
absolutely no doubt about it.
Wales
they're going to do very well, and they're going to
actually,
take...
Actually, Labour are doing better than them at the moment,
well, that's
actually.
Because Drakeford is actually quite sensible.
Well, maybe, as a lot of people are annoyed with him. But anyway, no, Wales is an absolute majority for Brexit, so I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and as Danny Dawling of Oxford University pointed out... That majority was made up of English incomers. In North Wales, they were solidly against Brexit. Plaid Cymru wants to rejoin the EU, as the SNP
well,
do.
I think,
and the majority
it's
in Northern Ireland was 60% to remain in the EU.
It's quite feasible.
The UK is going to break up. That's what's going to happen.
Well,
next.
Maybe. Possibly not. And possibly Nicola Sturgeon will get egg on her face when the Scots say, actually, we want to stay within the UK. But the main point here is, you know, you can keep making up any sort of excuse not to do Brexit, but it's just going to sink and destroy the Labour Party. And that's the example from Hartlepool.
The Labour Party's got a fundamental problem, which is it's two parties in one party. The fundamental problem in Britain is the first-past-the-post electoral system.
What do you think
I shouldn't be in the same party
Martin,
as
just
Peter
going
Mandelson.
Over the same ground here. What do you think would have happened if Jeremy Corbyn had been unequivocally pro-Brexit in the 2019 election?
What would have happened is...
He would have lost, would he?
In places like Bristol...
You think he would have lost?
People would have voted Lib Dem.
Do you think he would have lost these Red Ball seats?
He may well have done. Because don't forget, he's got this anti-Semitism allegations. The army have said he's not to be Prime Minister. This isn't a democracy. Some people are allowed to have a chance to win. Corbyn wasn't one of them.
Well, I gave you an opportunity to answer that, but you didn't. Okay. Anyway, I'll put a link up
if
to the
Corbyn
to
had
the
been
Larry,
anti-Brexit, then lots of people wouldn't have voted for the Labour Party in the parts of the country which would very strongly Remain. He would have lost all of the under 25 votes.
But you do know, don't you, that almost all the constituencies that he lost were pro-Brexit ones, and those were the
yes,
ones that lost
Brexit,
in the election.
Brexit is fundamentally a diversion. And it's basically
well,
a waste of everybody's
no,
time.
No, it's not a waste
it's
of everybody's time.
It's going to be negative for the British
it's
economy.
It's not, Martin. It's definitely not.
No, the banking system is what we should have been talking about.
Martin,
we're talking about Brexit
you always
instead.
Want to talk about something else.
B begins B. I want to talk about banking, not Brexit. It's
the
Tory party
about
wanted to talk about Brexit. Now they don't want to talk about it, and we want to carry on talking about it. It may lose us votes. I don't care, because the system is rotten to the core.
There we go, okay.
No, the system
that's
is rotten
a bit
to the
of an
core.
Admission, isn't
well,
it?
If I was in Northern Ireland, I'd be in Sinn Féin. And if I was in Scotland, I'd probably be a Green voter. But I'm stuck in silly old England, and I've got to be a member of the Labour Party, and I've been a member since 1975.
You're not stuck here. You could go to China if you want to.
If I was in China, I probably would be in the Communist Party.
Probably,
you're probably right about that.
But anyway, the point being that actually the Brexit voters were it was the Brexit attitude of Jeremy Corbyn, the pro-Remainer attitude, which almost certainly lost him that 2019 election, and he could have won on the first pass of the post. No, this is my point I'm trying to make.
No, he might have won on the first pass of the post if we hadn't had sabotage from the right wing of the party at every stage of the game. Yeah, that's what went on. They were determined that not to win because they didn't want him to win. So that full-time officials are actually working to sabotage the campaign. That is because we've got a first-past-the-post electoral system. And that's why we're stuck with these stupid full-time officials and they're stuck with
us. I think it's
and that's why we're stuck with a Tory government that's only got 43% of the vote.
But I think it's
which wouldn't be acceptable in Ireland, France, or Italy, or anywhere else.
I think it's much more to do with individuals naming no names within the Labour Party that have actually decided that they want to use the Labour Party for their own ideological ends and not actually looking at what voters want to win votes.
Well, you could argue that what we need to win votes is to move more to the right and accept all this stuff that...
Well, I'm not arguing that at all, am I? I'm not saying that at all. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn had a fantastic load of support, didn't he? He had whole loads and loads and loads of people joining him on the say-so that actually he was pro-Brexit. He was just going to go along with the way things were back in 2016.
Indeed.
And if he'd have carried on, we shall see. He would possibly... Yeah. Anyway, what I wanted to wind up by saying is until Labour... Remainers properly accept Brexit, the party will be stuck in limbo. And I think that may be where you want to keep it, Martin.
Well, I think there's going to have to be ultimately a breakup of the UK, a change in the electoral system and a split in the Labour Party. But we're going to take the union money with us and we're going to campaign from the left. But we're going to have to change the system.
Here's another tack on all this. Why is it, do you think, that the people who've been so badly treated by the Labour Party's machinery, the apparatchiks, the same ones, that made such a mess here in Bristol, that people like Jeremy Corbyn, who's now been suspended from the party, and Ken Livingstone, who was expelled for stating historical facts.
He resigned, but yeah.
So these various people... there's Chris Williamson who lost his seat or whatever, and he couldn't get back in. There's a whole list now. I mean, we're actually talking now hundreds, including Jewish individuals who were removed from the Labour Party for anti-Semitism and have been completely disillusioned by it. Why haven't they actually, bit the bullet and started their own party? Because they could have been standing in these local elections. They might have done reasonably well.
All that would happen under first past the post is we'd peel off some Labour votes and let the Tories in. Everybody in Northern Ireland knows this.
Yes,
you've got to have two candidates at the ballot.
Hang on, the Brexit Party didn't do that. So, for example, if you had a radical, should we say, let's call it the Livingstone Party, for want of a better term, what they could do is if anybody was standing, Labour Party people like Zara Sultana up in Coventry were standing on what they considered to be a genuine left-wing platform rather than a Mandelsonian Tory blue Labour platform, they wouldn't stand in those seats. For example, they could easily do that. That's the sort of thing that the Brexit Party did, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting you should say that, and I'm sure there's plenty of discussion gone on about this over the years, about the possibility of trying to open the political system up to the left. But in actual fact, it's designed to nail us down. It's basically...
To nail Nigel Farage down, but he did a little duck and dive.
Yeah, but if people had carried on voting for Farage when and of course what happened in Hartlepool was
to interrupt you again, but quite a lot of the seats they didn't stand the candidates.
That's
did they?
Right.
So they made a very, very clever move of saying, well, actually, if we want what we want, then we're not going to stand against these people. We're not going to rob them of votes.
But a
lefty Labour Party could do the same with the Labour Party.
They could. They could. And of course, we've got trade union and socialist alliance candidates.
Rather than screaming and shouting about changing the system, you can use the system intelligently to get what you want.
Well, it's because it's very difficult. Team games are quite complicated because you've actually got to get
somebody's going to stop you.
Yes, and you've also.
I must stand. I've got to stand.
Well, indeed, and also you've got to
egos involved.
That's right. Football is like politics, is very simple, really, but it's actually incredibly complicated because you've got to build alliances and there's personalities and all the rest of it. I think, you see, because we've got the one saving grace of the mayoral candidate elections that we've just had is you've got a transfer vote. So people could legitimately vote for Tom, the trade union.
Baldwin, who we had on the show.
I don't think he won't get a massive vote. But it's not a wasted vote because you can then transfer to the Labour Party to keep the other side out. And that, of course, is exactly how it works in France. But, of course, Priti Patel wants to get rid of the transfer vote for mayoral elections. So, really, you could end up with a situation with somebody with maybe 30% of the vote having total power in a city like Bristol. Totally wrong, but there it is. The electoral system in the country allowed the Brexit referendum in the first place because it gave the Tories who didn't have a majority the power to bring it through. And we've ended up with the mess we've ended up with because they've radicalised at every stage. Don't forget that at one stage we were told that we weren't going to leave the single market. Now we're out with all the consequences. And of course those consequences have yet to come through. People think it's just COVID that's wrecked the economy, but they're going to find out.
So, in the Police and Crime Commissioner elections being counted today, it looks as if the Conservatives are ahead. This is just after 5 o'clock today. Mark Shelford is on 137,000, a lead of 44,000 over Kerry Barker, the Labour candidate's 94. 163,000. The other candidates clocked up 164,000 between them. So the second preference votes are all to play for. So it's not over yet. It might even be that the first preference votes, the Conservative wins, and then the Labour Party gets through on the second preference.
I think it's quite likely, because most people do, that Conservatives don't get transfer votes. You know, the Liberals.
So explain that. How does
well,
that
the Liberals and the Greens and Liberals will be making up the rest of that. The one they came third and fourth, I imagine. And those people are not going to vote Conservative. So if they all transfer to the Labour Party, then the Labour Party will win.
So you reckon that Kerry's in with a chop? But the thing is, it's all on the totals, isn't it? Because he's already in quite a lead. The Conservative candidate.
Well, how many other votes have
he's ahead? He's got a lead of 43,500 over the Labour guy at the moment.
Well, how many other votes
on the first preference?
Yeah, but how many votes are to be transferred? Obviously, they wouldn't. Be, well, if it wasn't enough, then there wouldn't.
So anyway, I'll try and keep an eye on this, and we may even have a result on that one before the end of the programme. So that's those police crime commissioners. Is a tight race, it seems, between the Labour's Kerry Barker and the Conservative Mark Shelford. The other one, of course, is the Metro Mayor. What does that Metro Mayor do? Do you know?
Well, I know, in theory,
Boris said he didn't even know who he was, and even though, you know, so he was saying, oh, yes, I have all these regular meetings with Boris, but Boris said, who's this guy?
Anyways. Well, indeed, the Metro Mayor, I mean, having an elected Mayor of Bristol and an elected Metro Mayor, I mean, what we've ended up with a series of bodgings, is an incredibly complex structure. And don't forget, we've got a Welsh Assembly, a Scottish Parliament, a Northern Ireland Assembly to tack on to it, to all of this as well. So, you know, it's becoming an increasingly baroque, creaky structure. And it's a lot
is
of
that
the
deliberate?
It is deliberate,
you know,
yes.
People just think, I don't understand this, I can't be bothered to vote.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have a written constitution in this country because, of course, at the end of World War II, Britain and the other allies imposed a pretty comprehensive democratic constitution on defeated Germany, but they didn't reform their own structures. They were the winners. So the structures which were originally evolved in the 18th century in this country to allow gentlemen to have disagreements about the running of the country have gradually been expanded to try and run a modern state. And of course, it's just not up to the job.
So let's have a look at another one of our or have a listen, sorry, to another one of our clips today. And this is looking at this street preacher, the arrest of this street preacher last weekend in Uxbridge. I just found this just unbelievable, really. Some guys stood there. He's actually up on he's a 71-year-old preacher who's been preaching for the last 30-something years in Uxbridge in London. And he stood there on a small stepladder with about three or four steps on it in Uxbridge reading out of the Bible, and he's arrested. And he's actually pulled off this stepladder by one of these police. It just seems, you know, this isn't equality, Martin. Anyway, surely the point is that we're going to hear a clip in a second, but what is the about it? I mean, this is surely illegal for the police to do this. These are basic, it's just the same as it would be with a Jew or a Muslim. They're basic protective views, and the idea that someone can class it as hate speech seems unbelievable to me.
Well, I don't know what's happened in this particular case. I mean, what's he said that the police... What are the police charging him with?
I think it's something to do with marriage. It's making the statement that marriage should be between a man and a woman.
Right. Well, OK, so in other words, that's then classified as hate speech because it's already been decided that that's not the case legally. I would regard that as overreaction by the police, totally unnecessary.
Well, but the point is that these are protected views in international law, and in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the European Declaration of Human Rights.
I happen to disagree with him. I'm perfectly happy for gay people to get married, but he's, I would argue, within his rights to say he doesn't agree with it.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to Baroness Fox. She's here on Talk Radio earlier this week discussing this particular case.
He's a street preacher. We've all heard them before.
Yeah.
Not to my taste, and quoting the Bible and reinterpreting it literally is certainly something that we might, you know, we might mock, and we should be free to mock it.
Yes.
Should we think it's a nonsense idea. But he was a 71-year-old man who's been a preacher for 35 years, and he was speaking to his conscience. Mm. And the part in the Bible that he read out was indeed about marriage should be between a man and a woman, which is in the Bible indeed. And this, of course, was then interpreted by some passers-by as being homophobic and a hate crime. Now, unless you're going to ban the Bible and make it illegal in this country, actually, the Bible is full of things that now would be interpreted as hate crimes. I'm amazed somebody hasn't tried to cancel it. But the way that the police dealt with this gentleman was, rather than telling the people who said, "I'm offended by him," telling them, "Well, you know, get a life, don't worry about it, you know what I mean?"
Don't stand and listen to it then.
Yeah, he's a 71-year-old, you know, Bible thumper, go away.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
They've been there for a long time. They said, "Oh, there might be an incident that we have to investigate." And they basically, effectively, pulled him off his made-up pulpit, standing on a box or whatever, and dragged him off. He was kept overnight for 21 hours, as I understand it. Now, it looks like they're not going to charge him, but what a humiliation. What a horribly frightening thing. And I think that if you're an atheist or you're religious in this country, you have to defend religious freedom and conscience. You have to allow people to say things that you find offensive. But religious freedom was one of the very first in the Enlightenment tradition that people realized that what freedom would mean, that you would allow people with mad religious views, wacky religious views that you didn't agree with, if that's your take, or that is the word of God, if that's your take, but you would allow that, you would tolerate it. Religious tolerance is hugely important. Too many people, certainly on social media, in my interactions, sort of immediately said, "Oh, the reason he's been arrested is because one of the police officers is a Muslim.
Mm.
This is, you know, an attack by Muslims on Christians." And you think, God, that's a horrible bit about the culture war, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's actually got nothing to do with it. This is a well and truly informed, not by anything to do with Islam, because, by the way, those people who espouse Islam might well be done on the same hate crime argument when it comes to things like gay rights and so on. So I think we have to be careful about overinterpreting it. What really worries me is that the police, in this sense, there's a kind of secular religion, which is, the secular religion is thou shalt not offend.
Mm.
And anyone who does is treated as a heretic, as a blasphemer, and dragged away. And I think that's a very dangerous situation. The police themselves should just instinctively use their judgment. And the fact that their instinctive judgment is always to arrest and to actually say you can't say that is a real change, I think, from the way that we've understood policing historically.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? And I don't know what you meant, because I know you're quite into this secular stuff, Martin. And she's really saying there that this whole secular attitude is almost like a religion in itself.
Well, I tend to agree with everything that was being said. Was that Baroness Cox?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with all of that. I mean, basically, the police didn't have calls. People say they don't like what he's saying. My answer to that is tough. If you don't like it, get on a soapbox on the other side of the road and argue the case for gay marriage. That'll annoy him, won't it?
Okay, so we're going to wind up our first part of the show now. But before we do that, we're going to take a little look at, well, it should be an enormous look, really, but it's just a little look. And that's at World Press Freedom Day. On Monday this week, we had 2021 World Press Freedom Day. Journalism, says reporters Sans Frontières, journalism is the vaccine against disinformation, but journalism is being blocked in more than 130 countries. They're saying, we're ringing alarm bells really here, saying that journalism is under attack all over the world. Who is responsible for that attack, Martin? Who do you think?
Well, there are different forces at work in different societies. I think the country with the most journalists being murdered is Colombia. And that's basically local drug cartels
The drug cartels are doing the killings. They're pulling the triggers, aren't they? But what, you know, who is behind this, really?
Well, ultimately, all systems of authoritarian power don't like people asking awkward questions, do they?
I mean, well, we've certainly found that out in Bristol.
That's just the way the world is. And being a journalist in many countries is very dangerous.
Well, actually, criminals rely on awkward questions not being asked.
Well, indeed. And of course, you've got
people, as we found with Lloyd's Bank.
Yeah, well, that's right. And of course, you know, in different countries, there will be different repressive mechanisms for controlling speech. And, you know, it's not as if this is a new phenomenon. It's been going on for a very long time.
RSF have done quite a good job. I'll put a link up on our show page to that at thisweek.org.uk. But they do single out China, I'm afraid, Martin, for some specific criticism. China is 177th, so they're bumping along the bottom of the Press Freedom Index. They continue to take internet censorship, surveillance and propaganda to unprecedented levels. Still firmly anchored among the index is worst countries, indicated in black on the World Press Freedom Map. And as I say, I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Right below China is the same trio of totalitarian countries that have historically occupied the bottom three places. Two are Asian, Turkmenistan and North Korea, and the third is African, Eritrea. Regardless of their continent, these countries maintain absolute control over all news and information, enabling the first two to claim they had no COVID-19 and the third to maintain complete silence about the fate of 11 journalists who were arrested 20 years ago, some of whom have allegedly been held in metal containers in the middle of the desert. The country that fell the furthest in 2021 was Malaysia, down 18 to the 119th position, where the problems include a recent anti-fake news decree allowing the government to impose its own version of the truth. Now, this is one of the things which is getting worse and worse, Reporters Sans Frontières say, is that the idea of, you know, we've got to stop fake news is being used as an excuse to censor important life-saving journalism.
Yes, and of course we've also got to ask the question, who are Reporters Sans Frontières? And of course they're often funded by things like the National, I'm not saying they are, but the, you know, the Chinese would say yes, but this is a rigged game which we are made to look as if we're losing, and we're not going to play it.
And is that all you got to say?
No.
Right, good. Carry on.
I'm just saying.
Carry on. RSF is funded by people like our own journalist union in Britain.
Yes, okay. But I'm just pointing out that sometimes, I mean, for example, Transparency International, which is about corruption, Britain appears at the top of the list of that as a not corrupt country, even though we've got the City of London, which actually absorbs all of the corrupt money from the rest of the world. So we probably should be right at the bottom of the list.
Well, no, not below China.
Well, no, China doesn't take in the amount of money we take in the City of London. This is about corruption, not about.
I mean, we heard earlier on, didn't we, with the Tristan Cork example at the Bristol Post about the way that the civic leaders are making sure that there's no criticism or minimal criticism of their a glorious mayor in the local newspaper and the way they've done that. I mean, that should send Bristol down a few notches on the RSF racket. Yeah. But ratchet, sorry. But it's not a racket. Sorry, RSF. But China is the massive restrictions they've got on in Hong Kong at the moment, Martin, really are appalling in terms of press freedom. So there's quite a lot of people saying a lot of things, doing things which simply aren't allowed to be reported at all. And you're not allowed to criticise President Xi in Hong Kong anymore. And so it's not surprising that they've fallen a couple of notches.
No, I mean, and do you know what? The Chinese government would just say, well, phooey, we don't care.
Well, can you imagine a British press that wasn't allowed to criticise Boris or Starmer? You know, what would it be? It would just be exactly what the Bristol Post has been forced to be today, and that is a massive billboard for a bunch of corporates. Mm-hmm. That's basically what we're talking about here. And I would suggest that a lot of this stuff to do with press freedom is, you know, you're talking about here the banks, the hedge funds. Yeah. They see not only democratic processes as being in their way, they also see journalists as being in their way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, recently there was a study about who thought their countries were democratic or how democratic you thought your country was. And you may be surprised to learn that something like 70-80% of people in China thought their country was more democratic. And that's because they're brainwashed, you could argue. Meanwhile, much lower percentages in countries like the United States.
Of all of the reports I've seen on this around the world, it's because each part of the world, I mean, Chinese don't think I've reported this at all, unsurprisingly. But you know what I found the best one? Because I did hunt around. I spent 15, 20 minutes hunting around looking at Al Jazeera did a fantastic report on this. I thought really good. And it's interesting, isn't it, how, you know, so RT, maybe they might do something, I'm not sure. But the West and the East, we say China and the Western press seems to be polarizing. So they're both going down the drain, but and it's only countries which have remained some sort of independence, like Russia, like Qatar, that are still able to really talk about this freely.
Yeah, I mean, we've now got a very, very competitive global media environment, and lots more very, very, muscular attempts to steer narratives and messages. We've got in this country our Brigade 77, 1,000 members of the British Army, all officers, and they spend all day sitting on the internet pretending to be people they're not in order to send messages, in order to try and, steer the popular mind in certain directions.
Well, not only that, let us be clear about this, right? Not only that, there's whole loads of private banks of trolls that people are paying for.
Yes.
You know, that. So, and also there's national governments doing this in their own national interest. And, it's not surprising, if voices like ours get drowned out in all this.
Well, that's right. We've got what's happened, obviously, since the invention of the internet, you've got a much wider spectrum of views being expressed. But at the same time, there's such a lot of stuff out there, and there's such a lot of effort being put into steering popular views, that it becomes very difficult for the ordinary person who's probably got a family and a job to keep up with what's going on in a responsible fashion, even if they wanted to. Because, of course, there's also an awful lot of infotainment out there. I mean, some people really do not ever consume news journalism. They basically spend their whole time consuming essentially entertainment and consumer product placing.
Well, there was a terrific clip. I would have liked to have brought it along, but I couldn't manage to transcribe it, download it in time. I think it was by the president of Azerbaijan. I'm not sure you've seen this, Martin, yet, who was being interviewed by, one of the international BBC TV correspondents, who was criticizing him for his lack of press freedom. And he just laughed, refused to answer the question. He said, well, what are you doing with Julian Assange? And he said, I asked you about something else. I said, well, I'm quite happy to answer your question, but will you tell me what is happening with Julian Assange? What is he actually guilty of? Why has he been kept in prison? And why is it that you're talking about restrictions on the press in my country, where this guy is one of the greatest investigative journalists in the world and editors, is behind bars in Britain for doing nothing?
Well, that's what Lavrov said when he was pestered by the EU delegate about what was happening with Navalny. He said, that's our business and it's our courts dealing with that. He's been charged with defaming a veteran and fraud. These are, criminal offences in our country, and he's been tried and found guilty. What's Julian Assange supposed to have done? And of course, the mainstream media here do not cover Assange. He's just rotting there in Belmarsh prison.
And
of course, what he uncovered is that we go around the world killing loads of people.
It's the Azerbaijani president, Ilham Aliyev, and he's basically getting fed up with the BBC.
And the number of internet users in Azerbaijan is more than 80%. Can you imagine the restriction of media in a country where internet is free, there is no censorship, and there are 80% of internet users? We have millions of people on Facebook. How can you say that we don't have free media? This is, a biased approach. This is an attempt to create a perception in Western audience about Azerbaijan. We have opposition, we have NGOs, we have free political activity, we have free media. We have freedom of speech. But if you raise this question, can I ask you also one? How do you assess what happened to Mr. Assange? Is it a reflection of free media in your country?
We're not here to discuss my
country. Let's discuss.
No, President Aliyev.
In order to accuse me, saying that Armenians will not have free media here, let's talk about Assange. How many years he spent in Ecuadorian embassy? And for what? And where is he now? For journalistic activity. You kept that person hostage, actually killing him morally and physically. You did it, not us, and now he's in prison. So you have no moral right to talk about free media when you do these things.
Returning to the conflict.
Better return to the conflict, because this is not what you like. You like only to accuse, only to attack. But look at the mirror. Look, I tell many times, before coming and lecturing us, and in your question, accusing me, it's not a question, it's accusation. You talk like a prosecutor. Why? If you're so democratic and so objective, why you keep Assange in prison? For what? You keep him in prison because of his journalistic activity.
I'm not keeping him in prison, President Aliyev.
But you don't like this.
It's not a question of don't like.
You are not used to this.
It's not the subject of our interview.
Because you are used only to attack.
It's not the subject of our interview. And with respect, President Aliyev.
It is not the subject of interview, but you raise it.
You raised it.
No, you raised it.
You raised the case of Assange.
You said Armenians, if you don't have a free media, you...
Anyway, so yes, that's the wonderful, I have to say, Azerbaijan president, I think I might go move to Azerbaijan, President Ilham Aliyev locking horns with Orla Gurin at the BBC, accusing him and his country of having terrible restrictions on press freedom. And he quite rightly has turned the tables on her, and it's quite obvious that she wasn't really used to that. That was a great little bit of press freedom there, wasn't it, Martin? But you know what? That will not have gone out on the BBC. What these very smart people in Azerbaijan did is when the BBC came along to film, they've got their own little camera running.
Yeah, because that you remember Tony Benn used to always record his own interviews on a tape recorder. So that if he was misquoted or somebody lied.
Or something had been edited out.
Yeah.
Yeah, he could. Yes, you're absolutely right, he did. And this is the one thing you've got to do with these sharks. And those are not Chinese sharks, they're BBC sharks.
Yeah, and I think there are legitimate criticisms of the way the Chinese run their show. But they do turn around and say, hang on a minute, you've invaded all the... They did a report the other way accusing the US, said you've invaded 7 countries in 5 years or whatever it is. You've killed thousands of people. You've got a secret prison system with no legal safeguards whatsoever where people can just be disappeared. You've supported, terrorists in Syria, etc. And yet you accuse us of being genocidal repressors of freedom of speech. Now, of course, it's pot, kettle, black all round, isn't it, really?
Yeah, but what is the actual chances for Julian? I mean, I do wonder whether maybe we don't need some sort of a raid, an active, snatch of Julian to help him get out, something from the annals of Alexander Dumas.
I think you're letting yourself run away with yourself there, Tony. It doesn't work like that. Belmarsh is the top security prison in Britain for a reason. If you had an insider, you might be able to get him out.
But
I don't think you're going to be able to manage.
Maybe we have got an insider, and they said the same about Colditz, didn't they?
Well, I mean, people like Blake. George Blake was sprung from prison by CND activists and escaped to Russia, if you remember. That was in the 60s. But I think because Assange is such an important political prisoner, they're determined he's not going to walk out, is he? What needs to happen is the courts in this country need to stand up and say there is no case to answer here. And then, of course, he should be in a position to sue for
massive
damages.
I don't agree. I think his supporters need to be a little bit more imaginative and recruit some people inside Belmarsh or, working for Securicorps or in the courts.
Well, even if he escaped, he could be recaptured and you'd have to hide him. You're living in a fantasy world.
It's not a fantasy world. There's a long, large, large network of Assange supporters out there who would protect him.
Maybe we should
if
be talking.
Even
if you were right about this, we certainly shouldn't be discussing.
Are you
it
saying yet. We shouldn't have the freedom of speech to discuss this?
Well, not if you want to actually carry out a raid on Belmarsh to rescue Assange.
Well, all I'm saying...
I don't think we should be discussing this with the microphones
I'm not actually trying to arrange one. All I'm suggesting is that something like that may be the only way to get him out of jail, even though he's not actually done anything.
What may happen, which will be an absolute disgrace, is that he dies in jail because he's not very well. And at that point, maybe we should go out and burn
suicide.
A few things
or
down.
Or commit suicide. Because that's what, yeah, I mean, he's obviously worried.
Or be said to be committing suicide. Because, as you know, people can commit suicide but not commit suicide. I think it's actually a real problem. It's a bad situation for him, but it's actually a real problem for the British government and the American government because they don't know what to do with
it. I think he's just...
They can't back down, but they can't stop
it. This is very much like the whole, Iran nuclear deal, Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe business. He's just being used as a political pawn now. He's a political prisoner.
Well, he is a political prisoner, there's no doubt about it. Nazim Nari Radcliffe, on the other hand, as Boris Johnson with the microphone on said, she wasn't on holiday, she was just training journalists. Now, she had a tourist visa, but she was quite possibly working for MI6 training journalists, which is actually illegal in Iran. So she probably would be legally detained, unlike Assange, who's done nothing against
British
law.
So what is going on, do you think, at the highest level between the State Department and the Foreign Office on this, you know, with Assange?
On Assange?
Yeah. I mean, he's being used as a pawn, but will they be saying, you know, would the Brits be saying, well, we'll do this little favour for you if you, you know, and then we'll deliver Assange or whatever?
Well, what happened what happened is that the woman in charge of the case said that he was potentially guilty of espionage, which isn't in fact a crime in this country. Espionage against the United States is not a crime in British law, but in any case,
no, it's a duty.
Well, you could argue that, but the point is, she said that she's unhappy with the conditions he would be held in America, so they didn't release, so that she wouldn't allow him.
This is what they call a technicality, isn't it?
It's a technicality.
But it's actually rather Weasley of her.
Yeah, it's a Weasley technicality, that's right. And the reason they did that is because they've got Assange now. They want to send a message to anybody else who's doing the similar sorts of journalism. This, you know, we will pursue you to the end of the earth. We're very vindictive. And of course, it's having the desired effect of intimidating mainstream journalists. Orla Gurran knows very well what would happen to her if she started tweeting about Assange as a BBC journalist. She'd be out on her ear pretty quick, wouldn't she?
Yes, and I think she'd also be made a hero by the majority of the country.
Yeah, but she's probably got a mortgage and kids and
in a public school and all these
and
bills
all the rest
to pay.
Of it, yeah.
Oh, yeah, right.
But the Assange case. Is basically, you saw Aliyev there, and the same with Xi Jinping or anybody else. They're going to say, don't accuse us of being, against freedom of speech. What are you doing with Assange? So you can see, in actual fact, from a political point of view, it leaves them in a weaker position than they would otherwise be.
Anyway, I will definitely put up
good for Julian Assange, because he's still winning, even though they've got him in prison. He's beating them because he's right and they're wrong.
But he's not able to get a lot of his WikiLeaks things out about spy televisions that spy on you and this sort of thing.
Well, I think there's a court case in Spain which has been brought forward because a Spanish security company were employed by the CIA to bug his meetings with his lawyer, all of which is illegal under Spanish law. And Balthazar Garzon, who's taken a strong interest in the case, he's come over to Britain to take an interest in the case. And he was the guy, of course, who sent Inigo, the socialist interior minister in Spain, to prison as a terrorist. He is taking an interest in this case. Lots of senior lawyers around the world are taking an interest in the case because it's very clear that it's absolutely wrong and unconstitutional. And when they ultimately have to release him, he is going to get massive damages from the British government.
Well, Edward Snowden on Radio Havana, Cuba, has been saying a Julian Assange prosecution shows that Biden is only paying lip service to press freedom, and also he's been slamming Harris and Blinken for celebrating World Press Freedom Day. How dare you, says Edward Snowden.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's all very well pointing the finger to China, and when the Chinese can just point the finger straight back and say, well, what's happening here then? What are we doing? What are you doing there that's any different from what we're doing in Hong Kong?
Okay, thanks to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers there. This show, by the way, is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week here on the PRSC stream, and also over Sunday lunch at Camberley's Radio Q UK.com. Join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world.
pleasure dome decreed by Kubla Khan.
So that was from the Winchester Cathedral Choir, the song, the hymn Jerusalem, followed by from Farewell to Kings, Rush, and the song, a bit of an excerpt actually from the song Xanadu from 1977. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. I thought we'd start, Martin, but there's a few things to run through, aren't there? Mainly, I think we're going to be looking at the spy cops in a minute, after the leak that the Special Demonstration Squad may just have been rebranded rather than anything being done about this horrific hacking of individuals' lives. In a way, this is the story of the decade, along with what we were hearing from Julian Assange on Julian Assange earlier, plus the Ivermectin Conference, heartfelt assessment from Bath-based evidence-based, well, Bath, I shouldn't say that, should I? Bath-based evidence-based medicine doctor. She is from Bath, and she is an evidence-based medicine doctor, runs a consultancy there. Tess Laurie. Also, Dr. John Lee explains the A to Z of how Sage, Boris, the pharma cheerleader, Starmer, have all got it so horribly wrong during the so-called pandemic. And two angles on the question. Do those who say voting is a waste of time have a point? The new documentary called Monopoly, Follow the Money, which is absolutely fascinating and is quite horrifying to see how much these big hedge funds and investment bankers were running the show. And secondly, former CIA Colonel John Stockwell from the 1980s interviewed on how the CIA control the media and run secret wars and help and the media helps them cover them up. So that's the main reason, I guess, why the CIA wanted to control the press in the first place in Operation Mockingbird, was to make sure they can run their secret wars with nobody telling the public what they're up to. But anyway, I thought we'd better start this week, Martin, and rather than go on about it, I think most people know a bit about the spy cops business. I mean, it's absolutely horrific the way that these police were paid to hack people's lives, many of whom hadn't even committed a criminal offence, literally on the say-so that they might commit a criminal offence and that the intelligence that they gathered might be very valuable when it came to stopping criminal offences. But much of what these direct action groups were doing, Martin, and campaign groups generally, wasn't even breaking the law, was it?
No. I mean, there are supposedly police controls over infiltrating things like criminal gangs, but this is a massive operation which cost many thousands of taxpayers' money.
Millions, I would
millions,
suggest.
Millions, quite possibly, and certainly, this is all really the deep state in the country controlling the progressive opposition by infiltration.
Okay, so we're talking...
And of course, they're not just watching either. They're actually actively sabotaging the various campaigns involved.
Well, actually steering them in the direction they would rather they went.
That's right. I mean, I was reading this week about Blair Peach, if you remember who he was. He was a New Zealand teacher in 1979, and on his way home from an anti-National Front demonstration in Southall, he was beaten to death, and the police eventually concluded that it was definitely one of the officers of the Special Patrol Group that had killed him.
Now, this is the guys we were hearing about. Oh, actually, no, that was, they were the people who came after the flying squad.
Special Patrol Group was a riot squad, effectively. Yeah. And of course, I demonstrated the following week in Southall about the murder, because that's what it was. But what's come out of the spy cops thing is his girlfriend was spied on for 20 years afterwards, and they infiltrated all of the campaigns which were campaigning for justice.
God, this
for
is
it.
As bad as the Stephen Lawrence business.
It is, and what is very clear is that anybody who was killed by the police, or the police had done something wrong, the campaigns which were set up to try and put those things right were all infiltrated by the police.
They're totally obsessive fascists who are totally out of control and unaccountable.
Well, they did. The other thing that was interesting is that they didn't infiltrate the far right. The far right were first infiltrated because they'd infiltrated somebody into the Workers' Revolutionary Party.
That was MI5's job.
Yeah, but MI5 were actually control of the Special Demonstration Squad. So it wasn't just the Met. They were answerable to the security services. And they'd got somebody infiltrated into the Workers' Revolutionary Party. And the Workers' Revolutionary Party, for their own interests, wanted to infiltrate the National Front. So they said to this guy, which was they didn't realise he was a police infiltrator, "Will you infiltrate the National Front for us?" And he did. He infiltrated the National Front on behalf of the Workers' Revolutionary Party, even though he was, in fact, a Metropolitan Police officer. You couldn't make it up.
Well, so was that intelligence then passed on to the Met as well?
Well, yes, they basically concluded would make him look more credible in terms of his Workers' Revolutionary Party role.
And all of the intelligence he gathered.
Well, that was the first time they'd infiltrated the far right. All of this spy cop stuff, they weren't infiltrating the far right at all. It was all the left. 100% virtual.
Now, I've just been reading a book about the Second World War activities of MI5, running spies in the UK. There were two main operations. One was what they called the Double Cross operation, which was people who they caught spying for the Nazis, who they would then turn. So, for example, someone was parachuted in to do some Nazi spying. They would detect them, and then they would start feeding them a whole smorgasbord, as this is a word you love to use, of information, some of which was correct, most of which was nonsense, in order to throw them off the scent. So these spies were what they called the double cross system. So the Nazis thought they were getting good information, but it was some fake information. So, for example, they'd burn a warehouse down, which was actually empty, and it had been empty beforehand. And then the Nazis would think, "Gosh, these spies are really good." But then the next information that they sent them would also contain complete and utter rubbish, designed like saying, "Oh, we've got information that the D-Day is going to be coming through Calais," this sort of thing. So that was a double cross network. And then there was what they called the fifth column, which is a whole bunch of people who were working with Victor Rothschild very closely. He was running this, basically. And they thought that they were spying for, they really did think they were spying for Germany, but they were all being run by MI5.
Well, these are basic tradecraft techniques with any spying. And you know, this the double crosses, triple crosses, and all the rest of it. It's what it's all about.
But the fifth column were great. They were out there recruiting more Nazi sympathisers during the war into what was actually an MI5 operation.
Yeah, well, that's what you do. I mean, some people during the war in Ireland thought they were joining the IRA, and, you know, basically agreed to join, and then were arrested for being members of the IRA because, in actual fact, the people that they were talking to were intelligence
agents. But you know what actually shocks me about this Spycots business is they took these things to even greater lengths with hacking lives, having kids, etc. So let's have a listen now to some of the rather harrowing testimony of some of the people who had their lives hacked by the Spycots.
In 2010, I was in the highly bizarre and, I thought, unprecedented position of doubting the identity of the man that I had been in an intimate relationship with for 6 years. Up until that point, I thought I'd met the man that I would be with for years and years.
I had a relationship with a man that I knew as Mark Stone. He moved into a house with me and some friends, and we lived together for over a year.
He got really involved in my family, from playing with my nieces and nephews with me, to coming to my father's funeral with me, to being the person that supported me after my father died.
He visited my parents on numerous occasions, and he attended my grandmother's 90th birthday, and he was my partner in just about everything. For 2 years.
My partner wasn't Mark Stone, who I thought he was actually the undercover cop, Mark Kennedy.
He was married with two children and he was at work.
I had a relationship with a man I knew as Mark Cassidy for 5 years, and we lived together. Mark disappeared from my life 16 years ago, and the damage that I experienced and the acute paranoia that I experienced for many, many years has subsided now, but is still there.
It definitely was their exit strategy. That's what they all did. Fake an emotional breakdown or have some kind of emotional breakdown and then vanish. The person I thought I'd been in a relationship was actually a fictional character that had been constructed between him and his employers, the Metropolitan Police.
What had felt like meeting someone who was really perfect and shared your interests was actually a sort of form of psychological manipulation that I think is known as mirroring, where the person that you're talking to is reflecting back what they think you want them to hear. And this person, it's very easy to be the perfect person in somebody's life when you actually don't exist, you're playing a role.
I had very profound issues, as do many of the women, around trusting new people.
You didn't just have a relationship with a man who didn't exist. You had a relationship with a man who didn't exist, and the backroom, and the managers, and the superior officers who were making the decisions about that relationship, and the support teams that were following him around on your holidays, and the people who were listening to your phone calls, and the people who were reading your emails.
I didn't really know who I was anymore. I'd grown and changed over that time with somebody who was fictional, and, you know, if they were fictional, then what did that make me now?
There are some women who have had children with undercover police officers, not knowing. There's one woman in particular who didn't know until 25 years later. There are other women who desperately wanted children, and through this experience were denied that opportunity because their years of fertility were stolen by these men. And then there are other women like me who've been fortunate enough to go on to have children, but still somehow, at some point have to explain to the children what this story is.
These units have been systematically abusing women since 1968.
All the police in that unit operating in that way had to be married to get the job because their employers thought that that gave them something to come home for.
They declined to prosecute the officers for sexual assault or misconduct in public office because they said the relationships were based on genuine feelings of mutual attraction. The consent was obviously negated by the huge level of deception. There is no way on this earth that anybody would consent to have a relationship with somebody if they knew that everything about that person was false and that that person was in their life to spy on them.
What a horrific story. What a horrific story that can be going on, possibly still is going on in this country right now, and that people haven't been prosecuted for it. I suppose the idea here is that if one of these women was raped by one of these men, these police, that actually they were doing so under the orders of a senior officer who doesn't really feel like he wants to go to jail for it.
Well, that's right, and of course the Tories have just passed this, or they're in the process of passing this spy cops bill, which will mean that in the future all police officers engaged in these kind of activities will be beyond the law. And of course they clearly are beyond the law, because they've decided that they're not going to prosecute anybody. Now this is exactly the sort of thing that leads people to conclude that this isn't really a democracy, and maybe we're going to talk about whether people should vote or not in a minute, but of course other people decide that it's time to take up arms, as they did in Ireland 30-40 years ago.
So why is it that people who are environmentalists, who are trying basically to do what Extinction Rebellion are doing now, in the, maybe the 1980s, 1990s, etc., why are they being treated actually worse than we treated people who were working for Hitler in World War II?
Well, it's because all power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The view in 1968 was all these people with their long hair and their funny ideas were a threat to the society. And therefore, it was very well understood in the establishment that they were going to do everything they could to sabotage these people's lives. And they set out to do it, and they did it.
I think what's going on now is the heart of the Home Office, particularly, which is where much of this is based, with the security service, MI5, the anti-terror police, special demonstration squad people at the heart of the Met, is actually far more rotten than it's ever been, actually.
Yes, and I think that's the reason why they brought these bills forward. I mean, basically, they had the powers to do all these things for years, so why do they need a bill allowing them to free rein? And that's because the deep state has got even deeper and more profoundly embedded in the society than it was before. Not least, of course, because of all the false flag terrorism which was being run from inside the security structure. And of course, that's not just having babies with people, that's blowing things up and killing people.
Well, many of these people, I mean, like Helen Steele was the name of the woman you heard there, the last person who spoke. She, I remember first coming across, I think it was in the 90s, and the McLibel case with her and that's Dave right. Morris actually making, all they were doing basically was making doing leafleting outside McDonald's, and I remember actually in Oxford it was great fun doing exactly taking copies of their leafleting outside McDonald's there, because they were on trial for those specific leaflets at the time. So there was a whole load of us when we were living there went and did that. Her situation is that she's had to spend decades being stalked by these people basically for her political views.
Well, it's more than likely that quite a few people, perhaps in this room, have been surveyed in this way. And it's quite clear from, I've been very active in left-wing political causes for many decades, and it's almost certain that we will have run into people who are basically spying on us. No doubt about
relationships,
it.
You mean relationships?
Well, relationships maybe, but certainly people sitting in meetings. No doubt about that.
But the thing is, I think that's what makes this so exceptional and so horrific, is the... Anyway, I'll put a link up to the full version of that. It's an unlisted video, but you'll find it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. Absolutely horrific, and shared by the Canary. And it was actually part of the we'll finish, I think, now on this topic, but by mentioning the fact that what the Canary are implying in their article, which we discussed a bit more thoroughly last week, Martin, is that all that's really happened with this is there's been a bit of a rebranding going on, a bit like, you know, changing the name of Windscale to Sellafield.
Indeed, and don't forget that the Spy Cops Bill, the Armed Forces Bill, and the Intelligence Services Bill give all agents of the British Deep State complete carte blanche, including murder. I mean, I just can't... I find that absolutely extraordinary. You know, if you put a bill before the Russian Duma that the security services should be above the law, up to and including murder, they'd laugh it out of the court. But in Britain, the Tory government, with a majority of 80, has just basically given the green light to murder by the security services. And that's because they've been involved in murder in the past. We're not just talking about infiltrating groups and giving people babies. We're talking about blowing things up and killing people. And, of course, a lot of that went on in Northern Ireland.
So the life hackers get to make the law?
That's right. But I think the fact that they brought these laws forward shows that where their intentions are. And, in fact, that they are worried that if the law was genuinely enforced and if this was a rule of law country, then top generals, top intelligence service people, top police officers would have to go to prison.
Well, there's also this right-wing blacklist, isn't there, which is related to a lot of this, and that is the Economic League, Caprim, these blacklists of left-wing activists, and that's where a lot of the information comes from for the police in order to decide who they're going to hack.
Well, we saw what happened with the Shrewsbury 2 case after 50 years. Des Warren and I've forgotten his name now, Royal Family guy. they basically were sent to prison for 2 years, and ultimately they've been cleared because they didn't do anything. But it took 50 years, and of course they never worked in the building industry again, which was quite good for the guy's name escapes me because he went on to be an actor. But Des Warren died quite young, quite possibly as a result of the drugs that he was given in prison when he was in prison for trade union activity.
Yeah, so as the fascist state marches forward and we have another local election, let's have a listen now to, now everyone's hopefully done their voting yesterday. I'm going to really disillusion people now and say, well, maybe there was no point in it. Well, actually, of course, there always is a point. Even if it makes a tiny difference, it's still worth a difference that's worth making. And it sends a sign, you know, that we are intelligent human beings rather than a bunch of sheep that just want to be herded around. And here is a clip now from this new documentary called Monopoly, Follow the Money, because I thought it's fascinating to look at the extent to which our world is a kind of illusion. We're really the owners of everything and everybody. All the goods and services, pretty much, are a bunch of banksters.
Dear fellow human, I think by now you're sensing that something does not seem right. But I also think that poorly argumented conspiracy theories have caused you to stay far from the fear-mongering media and conspiracy theorists alike. But please listen, because as you are watching, millions fall into poverty because of the corona measures of the past year. Even if the greatest economic crisis in history has not affected you yet, it will only be a matter of time until the rippling effects will hit you as well. This is not fear-mongering, but it's a harsh reality. I also think we might mitigate the damage and may even do better provided we are informed correctly about our situation. This is why I would like to show you a few facts you can easily check, facts that are of crucial importance. Less than a handful of big corporations dominate every aspect of our lives. That may seem exaggerated, but from the breakfast we eat to the mattress we sleep on and everything we wear and consume in between is largely dependent on these corporations. Those are huge investment companies that determine the course of money flow. They are the main characters of the play that we are witnessing. I know your time is valuable, so I summarized the most important data. How does it work? Let's take PepsiCo as an example. It is the parent company of many soda companies and snack companies. The so-called competitive brands are from factories from a few corporations who monopolize the entire industry. In the packaged food industry, there are a few big companies, like Unilever, the Coca-Cola company, Mondelez and Nestle. In the picture, you see that most brands in the food industry belong to one of these corporations. The big companies are on the stock market and have the big shareholders in the board of directors. On sources like Yahoo Finance, we can see detailed company info, such as who the biggest shareholders actually are. Let's take PepsiCo again as an example. We see about 72% of stock is owned by no less than 3,155 institutional investors. These are investment companies, investment funds, insurance companies, banks, and in some cases, governments. Who are the biggest institutional investors of PepsiCo? As you can see, only 10 of the investors own together nearly one-third of the stock. The top 10 of investors together amount to a value of $59 billion. But out of those 10, only 3 own more stock than the other 7. Let's remember them and look up who owns the most stocks of the Coca-Cola company, the biggest competitor of Pepsi. The biggest lump of stock is again owned by institutional investors. Let's look at the top 10 and start at the bottom 6 of them. 4 of these institutional investors we also saw at the bottom 6 of PepsiCo. These are Northern Trust, JP Morgan Chase, Geode Capital Management and Wellington Management. Now let's look at the 4 biggest stock owners. They are BlackRock, Vanguard and State Street. These are the world's biggest investment firms, so PepsiCo and Coca-Cola are not competitors at all. The other big companies that own a myriad of brand names like Unilever, Mondelez and Nestlé are from the same small group of investors.
Now, let me suggest here that what we're looking at really is a Fourth Reich, Martin, a far-right group of people who have just decided that they own the world and they're going to do what they want with it. They're going to buy political parties and they're going to buy and close down the media if they don't like it.
Well, we've definitely got a ruling elite which is very heavily integrated. And you might wonder why, if you've got something like BlackRock controlling both Pepsi-Cola and Coca-Cola, why they don't just merge it into one brand. And the answer to that is, what advertising does and branding does is it creates a barrier to entry to new firms into the industry. Because none of them, if you wanted to compete with Pepsi and Cola and Coca-Cola, you would have to have the same kind of advertising budgets, and even then you'd be up against this, the fact that they've been around for years.
This advertising, of course, is written off. It's profits that are written
off. That's
right.
Well, yeah, but don't forget, what ultimately develops is an oligopolistic market structure, which is controlled by the finance, insurance and real estate sector. The industry in the West has been gradually financialized, which ultimately means that smaller and smaller numbers of people control more and more stuff. And of course they're the ones who work with the intelligence services and the military. There is definitely a power elite which dominates the society despite the facade of having elections.
And also, yeah, but we've got these revolving doors too.
That's right.
Yeah. So they're straight into government, in and out of government, and the civil service now too.
What's happened recently with the civil service, you see, top civil servants used to be career civil servants, so that, you know, they would never be able to leave the civil service and go and work in private industry, and they basically were supposed to be not from private industry, but of course that's gradually broke down. But people can just, you know, go from one to the other and all the rest of it. But what it does is it undermines the independence of the civil service. So instead of being, you know,
constantly there, you know, being tempted with bribes.
That's
saying,
right.
Well, look, if you want to do X, Y, and Z, we'll make sure you've got a seat on the board of this company where you have to come
that's
to five
right.
meetings a year and you're going to get paid 250
that's,
grand.
That's right.
It's just bribery, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite difficult to keep an independent civil service.
In a way, you're being brought into a cult like that, aren't you? Because you're saying, look, you know, we've done this little job for you, and so therefore, you know, we know you're going to keep your mouth shut.
Well, at every level, people know what level they're on and the people above them. And you know, it's a system whereby if you want to climb the levels, you've got to be acceptable to the people above you. And that is the way the world
but
works.
It's like the sort
and
of
it's the way, and that's how it is.
It's like the bully boy teenage gangs on an international organised level.
That's
crime.
Right. Well, I mean, when I've been talking about people being at Eton College, for example, when you're 13 or 14 years old, you are basically, it's like joining a gang in one of the ends. You basically say, well, this is what we do. So, for example, when this deal was done with the nuclear weapons in South Africa, what happened is people went round to people they knew, people they'd been to Eton with, and said, you know how it works. We need some money, and then we will double your money in 6 months. Don't ask us how. And, of course, because you are a trusted member of this group, then you hand your money over on the assumption that you're going to have your money double. It's the alternative investment market. It basically does all sorts of dodgy deals in Africa, you know, taking cobalt out of the Congo and so on. And basically, if you're an insider in the alternative investment market, you hand over your cash to have it doubled or trebled. And of course, this cannot be legal business. because legal businesses don't make that level of profit. And of course, sometimes you can be burned if you and you get involved and you realise you shouldn't have trusted whoever you gave the money to.
Well, what about Dan Norris, who's the Metro Mayor candidate for the West of England? His votes will be being cast any time now or soon, and he's very unlikely to win, I would say, because it's the whole system is set up so that the Tory wins.
Well, there is a transfer vote here. Well, so I'm saying the possibility is open that he might win.
He might possibly win. But anyway, Dan has been involved in this whole business of the guarantees about the Iraq war and weapons of mass destruction. This missing letter that we've talked about a few times on here that was written by Tony Blair guaranteeing him that there was no connection between any missing nuclear weapons that have been being sold dodgily for to raise money for the Conservative Party or for any party in Britain and with regard to the Iraq war. And he was a whip at the time that was whipping the Labour MPs to all vote for it. So it'd be interesting to see what happens with that. But these revolving doors, and he's suddenly appeared out of nowhere. He hasn't been anywhere near Bristol for 10 years, but suddenly he's the candidate for the Labour Party.
The reason he's the apparatus candidate, that's why.
Anyway, so that documentary, we just heard a little clip from, I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It's called Monopoly, Follow the Money. Final question, though, on this, Martin, is Yahoo Finance. She's saying the Dutch lady going at having have a look at this. But, of course, we know here in Bristol our very own Illuminati that own the place. They've owned the show for the last 400 or 500 years. The Merchant Venturers, they're constituted under a 16th century royal charter. And you won't find anything about them on Yahoo Finance, will you?
No. And because that we know about them, there are other groups. I mean, she mentioned BlackRock.
Well, what do we know about them?
Well, yes, but we know they exist.
there are other groups out there who are
operating. We don't even know what they're called or who's in them. And of course, the question we were asking at the beginning of this section was, is it worth voting? And not voting doesn't stop these people. Yeah. I've got some sympathy for those who say the whole thing is rigged.
Self-indulgent, right, in saying that we should raise this question from time to time, because of course it is worth voting, even if it makes a small difference.
You may, for example, under certain circumstances, want to boycott a vote because you don't think it's fair.
Well, you should at least
spoil your ballot paper anyway. But in any case, you might have an organised boycott of an election. I mean, for example, there have been various referendums in Northern Ireland about whether it should remain part of the UK. And what generally happens is the nationalist side refuse to participate because they know they're going to lose. And that what they would say is, why don't we have an election in the whole of Ireland?
Why don't the Labour voters refuse to participate in the Metro Mayor election then? Because they know they're going to lose. The whole thing is rigged against them.
No, it's not. In the Metro Mayor election, there is a transfer vote. We talked about what was happening earlier. The Tories
are very unlikely, Martin. Well,
it may be.
The whole system was set up, wasn't it?
Yeah.
To make sure that you've got a wide enough area around Bristol that you're going to include enough of these leafy Tory shires in order to make sure that the Conservatives win it. So it's not really much of a vote.
Yeah, well, if Priti Patel has her way, it was just a first-past-the-post election, the Tories would already have won it. But they didn't dare to bring in that for things like this because it would end up with a situation where anybody could win on a minority of the vote. And of course, you know, it's going to be very clear that they haven't got a mandate.
Let me just wind up this by saying something about what we do know about the Merchant Venturers and where their money is. We certainly know that some of their individuals are, first of all, the former master of the Merchant Venturers, John Savage, is very influential, or was anyway, in the Labour Party. He's also the chair for many years of Business West. So he was the guy who was sitting next door to Common Purpose for many years. Up at Lee Court there, and he was a right-wing member of the Labour Party who left when Jeremy Corbyn came around, but he's been one of the people who's been pushing for many years for the Arena, and been involved in that scandal. So what you've got here is a whole bunch of people in the background who are merchant venturers who've taken a great role. Of course, George Ferguson, who was our mayor, was a former merchant venturer. But most people have said about him, at least I would, I don't know what you make of this, Martin, saying that, well, he was brought into the Merchant Venturers because he was a very influential architect and they didn't really want him outside the city establishment. They'd rather have him inside.
Well, that's how these elite groups work, isn't it? best of all, I mean, the whole idea behind common purpose is that whatever party you're a member of, Tory or Labour or whatever, you've got a common purpose, and you've been through, you know, you've had the same kind, you know, this is what realistic modern leaders have to look like, sound like, you know, we've got to get rid of any kind of crazy ideas they may have had, knock all the edges off them, and then they can be acceptable, to the establishment. And that's a game that's been going on for a very long time, isn't it?
So the merchant venturers have been involved in the, discovery of North America. Although the money came from the Bardi Bank in Italy, they arranged the trip of John Cabot in 1497 that discovered North America, so-called, even though the Phoenicians had probably discovered it a long, long time beforehand anyway. When that happened, we then had the slave trade, with tens of thousands of African slaves even being thrown overboard dead on that journey. So that's the Merchant Venturers too. Edward Colston, you know, the statue disappearing at last after many years of campaigning, and a bit of direct action sorted that out. But then we've also had the privatisation in the 1980s, Margaret Thatcher and all that. It's quite clear if you look at the boards of many of these privatised utilities, particularly things like Wales and West Utilities, Bristol Water, etc., that's where you'll find these merchant venturers now basically taking over from where the government used to, you know, the services the government used to provide, at cost. And, you know, okay, so they make a little bit of profit, but they were making sure that, for example, that the water system, the electricity, the transport systems were all run openly in public. Now it's like a cult. They're running it themselves. And every time we switch the toaster on or the tap on here in Bristol, the merchant venturers are getting their cut.
That's true, and they've also become very big players in the schools in the city, as I know, because I've worked in some of them.
And the health service, of course, yeah. They have merchant venturers chairing the various NHS trusts, and also chief executives of some of those trusts as well are merchant venturers.
That's right, and of course...
Wherever there's money, they seem to arrive and requisition it.
Well, I mean, it's hardly a surprise that the oligarch, I mean, you know, Bristol was traditionally an oligarchy run by the merchant venturers and others close to them. And that was the way that cities functioned. And, you know, Britain has never, there was a kind of a revolution during the 1640s. But by the glorious revolution of 1688, a stable configuration was set up.
The 1640s was a civil war. It wasn't a revolution, was it?
Well, I mean,
it was one ruling class taking over from
another. Well, no, you could argue that it was a revolution. But what the Marxists used to argue, like Christopher Hill, who was at Balliol, was that this was the bourgeois revolution, a bit like the French Revolution or the American Revolution. In other words, the feudal crass were pushed aside by the merchant class. That's right.
Yeah, which doesn't seem to me like really a revolution. It's a civil war.
Well, it is
the merchants.
It depends on the means. What you mean by the word revolution, doesn't it? Because before that, the word revolution
completely overturning the establishment. No, it's a war between two aspects of the establishment.
Well, yes, I know, but at the same time, in traditional Marxist theory, like the human society is a progressive struggle. So you establish the feudal system is overthrown, the capitalist system is brought in, and of course in the schema, the traditional Marxist schema, there then be a socialist revolution which removes and overthrows capitalism. But that's particularly a particular use of the word revolution. In the Middle Ages, the word revolution just meant somebody else coming to power and then falling from power and somebody else coming
well,
after.
Well, in my words, the revolution means something like happening in Cuba, you know, where you've got actually a whole oligarchy being booted out and a new bunch coming along.
Yeah, well, that's
now, they're obviously, they're a very problematic situation because quite often you've got a whole load of people waiting in the wings, just as bad as the previous lot, ready to take over.
Indeed. So in other words, you know, there's an awful lot of discussion in politics departments about what the word revolution means.
Anyway, so the merchant venturers, they're still in charge around here. They own the place. Basically, they own almost everything we're having a sip of water here. They own that. A little bit of the coffee. Well, they own the water that came into the tap and came into the coffee. They may even have shares in the coffee company.
If you remember when we had the merchant venturers on the show, the only time they ever turned up, it turned out that the guy whose name Chris Coverdale, I think it was, who'd been elected their leader for the year, that very morning, Bristol Water had been charged in court with the worst overcharging in the country. And everybody knows that First Bus is the most expensive rip-off in the country.
They all tend to be corporate lawyers, you know, who've made their living out of just basically bullying.
I think there's a bit of a different
course.
If you look at globally, the heads of big companies in countries like Japan and Germany tend to be engineers.
Well, it starts.
The heads of big companies in US and Britain are lawyers.
It starts to look like almost like a religion based around money. Like the acquisition of cash and resources that are bought with that cash is all that matters. Nothing else. There's no morality. So they may come along and bow to the altar at Bristol Cathedral once a year, but that's as far as it goes.
Well, I mean, traditionally, the justification of the ruling classes was that, you know, God's in his heaven, all right with his world, that a place for everybody and everybody in their place.
I do get asked sometimes about how do we find out about their finances? How much money have they got? Where are their investments? Who owns, you know, where are their shareholdings? And the only way you're allowed to find out is you have to go down to West Harptree, opposite the church, knock on the door there, and have a chat with a bloke called Jacob Rees-Mogg. And Jacob Rees-Mogg is the chairman of the Privy Council. Only the Privy Council are allowed to scrutinise the accounts of the merchant venturers. And I think it's about time they did so, but particularly because of their insulting logo, which is up on their gates, up on the promenade at their merchant's hall, which is in Latin. But if you translate it into English, Martin, it says, "The poor are ignorant and will suffer much."
Well, you couldn't make it up, could you?
No, you certainly couldn't. Anyway, so what with our CIA, Harvard, Yale mayor, or whatever it is, it's the skull and bones as well, isn't it? I thought it'd be useful to have a listen to the CIA colonel, John Stockwell, talking about control of the press back in the 1980s. He wrote one of the best titled books of any whistleblower in history, Martin. Do you know what that is?
No.
It's called In Search of Enemies, and that's actually the title of his book about Angola and various other things as a whistleblower from the CIA in the 80s that he did. Anyway, so In Search of Enemies, that's what they were. They're just this organisation that's looking to pick fights all around the world. So here's John Stockwell now with a little thing about the media agents of the CIA and also Operation Mockingbird, how they managed to get away with having loads of secret wars, because the Central Intelligence Agency really seems to me seems to be running the show right now around the Western world, or at least doing its very best to.
There are other functions, however, some of them more legitimate than others. One is to run secret wars, the covert action that's written and talked about so much, like what's happening in Nicaragua today from Honduras. Another thing is to disseminate propaganda to influence people's minds, and this is a major function of the CIA, and unfortunately, of course, it overlaps into the gathering of information. You have contact with a journalist, you will give him true stories, you'll get information from him, you'll also give him false stories.
Did you do buy his confidence with true stories?
You buy his confidence and set him up. We've seen this happen recently with Jack Anderson, for example, who has his intelligence sources, and he has also admitted that he's been set up by them. You know, every fifth story just simply being false. You also work on their human vulnerabilities to recruit them in a classic sense, to make them your agent so that you can control what they do, so you don't have to set them up sort of, you know, by putting one over on them. So you can say, here, plant this one next Tuesday.
Can you do this with responsible reporters?
Yes, the Church Committee brought it out in 1975, and then Woodward and Bernstein put an article in Rolling Stone a couple of years later. 400 journalists cooperating with the CIA, including some of the biggest names in the business, to consciously introduce the stories into the press.
Well, give me a concrete example of how you use the press this way, how a false story is planted and how you got it published.
Well, for example, in my war, the Angola war that I helped to manage, one third of my staff was propaganda. Ironically, it's called covert action inside the CIA. Outside, that means the violent part. I had propagandists all over the world, principally in London, Kinshasa, and Zambia. We would take stories which we would write and put them in the Zambia Times, and then pull them out and send them to a journalist on our payroll in Europe, But his cover story, you see, would be that he had gotten them from his stringer in Lusaka, who had gotten them from the Zambia Times. We had the complicity of the government of Zambia, Kenneth Kaunda, if you will, to put these false stories into his newspapers. But after that point, the journalists, Reuters and AFP, the management was not witting of it. Now, our contact man in Europe was. And we pumped just dozens of stories about Cuban atrocities, Cuban rapists. In one case, we had the Cuban rapists caught and tried by the Ovimbundu maidens who had been their victims. And then we ran photographs that made almost every newspaper in the country of the Cubans being executed by the Ovimbundu women who supposedly had been their victims.
But these were fake photos?
Oh, absolutely. We didn't know of one single atrocity committed by the Cubans. It was pure, raw, false propaganda to create an illusion of communists, you know, eating babies for breakfast and that sort of totally false propaganda.
Totally false, Martin. And how to create an illusion that a war is necessary, happening, etc.
Yeah, and in fact, but the what they're doing now is far more sophisticated and much more high level than it was in those days. There's the intelligence services. Just think about something like the Department of Homeland Security in the US, which never existed before 9/11. It now has 1 million employees. What do you think they do all day? They basically make stuff up. And then people go to the ballot box, having been fed all of this stuff. Their own taxes have paid for the misinformation. And then they, and of course we've now got to, if people buy into a particular, you know, if people like if the Tories do well, for example, in this local election, all questions of their malfeasance in various things will be ignored because the ultimate test is the ballot box. But the ballot box isn't free because people, A, haven't got the information, and B, it's rigged even if they did have the information.
What do you make of John Stockwell, though? Because, I mean, we don't really seem to get many people like him anymore, do we? That's why you have to go all the way back to the 80s to find someone who's prepared to speak out.
What happened with those people is various people spoke up and grasped up what was going on, and they're just that much more careful about who they recruit and what they do with people if they step out of line.
Or they send messages to them with things like what happened to Dr. David Kelly in 2003.
Well, absolutely. And that's the way it works. And it's the way you'd expect it to work. You know, they are very active. I say this on RT all the time. The Western intelligence services are not shrinking violets. They are very active. They've got massive resources. They are linked into the drugs trade. And they try to manipulate elections all over the world or overthrow people completely if they don't toe the line.
Well, just after,
and of course this is well known in places like China and Russia, and they're getting fed up with it.
Just after the 2010 election, Gareth Williams, he was just about 32 years old, was a wealth mathematician and an employee of GCHQ, seconded to the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6. He was found dead in suspicious circumstances at a security service safe house in Pimlico on the 23rd of August 2010. Martin, the police said there was nothing suspicious about it, even though his body was in a holdall and had been chopped up.
Yeah, and of course, when somebody who is in the Special Intelligence Service, Secret Intelligence Services, sees that, they know that if they step out of line, this may happen to you. Because then obviously nobody's going to follow that up. The police are just ignoring it because they're under orders. Now that means that there isn't really a rule of law. And of course, you're kind of making a potential terrorist case for them. There's no way of changing this system by legitimate means. We're going to have to use illegitimate means. That doesn't necessarily follow, but you can see why that argument might be made.
Well, let's get into talking a bit about the COVID now. And I thought we'd have a listen to a couple of people, particularly Dr. Tess Laurie, because we interviewed her about 3 or 4 weeks ago. She's based here in Bath. She's got something called the Evidence-Based Medicine Consultancy. She's a long-time doctor who's got fed up over the years of seeing the pharmaceutical industry bully its way into the policy forums and all sorts of decisions being made as a result, which result in the deaths of many people, but the massive increase in the profits of the pharmaceutical companies. She's originally from South Africa. now in Bath, but she held an ivermectin conference last weekend, the weekend before, and they took a few days to upload their various clips to the internet. But she summed up the conference at the end of it, and talking about what she describes as a kind of medical tyranny, and she believes that the World Health Organization must be replaced for the benefit of mankind. Otherwise, more and more people will be being killed by the diabolical decisions being made by the World Health Organization.
Before we end, I would like to share with you a few reflections on ivermectin and the state of affairs with regard to evidence-based medicine. As a scientist tasked with providing evidence along evidence-based medicine principles, I have become aware that the hierarchical approach to evidence synthesis, where systematic reviews sit at the top of the evidence pyramid and expert opinion and consensus at the bottom, is no longer appropriate. This is partly because the integrity of systematic reviews and meta-analysis has become degraded by the increasing requirements about the conduct of randomized controlled trials, the considered gold standard of clinical studies, that favor the pharmaceutical industry. Large randomized trials have become hugely resource intensive. 70-page trial protocols and grant applications require months of time and expertise to jump through all the hoops required for processing and authorization. In addition, they cost millions of dollars. These requirements play into the hands of Big Pharma, who are the only ones who can afford such trials. Large randomized clinical trials of generic medicines and non-pharmaceutical interventions, which deserve to be evaluated for a number of viral and cancerous conditions, are rare because, frankly, there is no money to be made and there is no funding available. In my experience of evaluating trial reports of novel anti-cancer agents, it is common that early trial findings showing benefit leading to the drug's approval are contradicted by later evidence showing no benefit. By then, the drug has already been licensed for use, and the pharmaceutical company has already made billions. For this reason, I caution against the unquestioning acceptance of data provided by the developers of novel treatments and strongly suggest these need independent evaluation. Not by academics and institutions receiving unlimited research grants and funding from the pharmaceutical industry and their associated fund companies and charities, but by independent, objective scientists with no conflicts of interest. It is time we recognize and scrutinize the involvement of industry and institutions once known for their scientific integrity, and all the so-called public-private partnerships and charitable foundations that have facilitated the corruption of science and our honorable profession, healing. They who design the trials and control the data also control the outcome. So this system and focus of industry-led trials needs to be put to an end. Data from ongoing and future trials of novel COVID treatments must be independently controlled and analyzed. Anything less than total transparency cannot be trusted. With regard to the evidence pyramid, there needs to be a new approach, an integrated evidence approach, instead of a tiered hierarchical approach. Instead of a pyramid, in my opinion, a circle would be more appropriate, where the center represents the integrated body of evidence from different sources. Systematic review and meta-analysis of randomized trials would then represent one of several types of evidence, including observational studies, real-world data, qualitative data on people's views and experiences, and doctors' expert opinion. This would inform clinical practice decision-making in a much more holistic way. All of these different types of data are critical to the big picture, and integration of these data has been absent in the evaluation of all interventions imposed on the public over the course of the last year. Instead, authorities have cherry-picked science and the scientists to support their flawed decision-making processes. The story of ivermectin has highlighted that we are at a remarkable juncture in medical history, where rigorous scientific evidence, our training and experience, the tools that we use to heal, and our connection with our patients are being systematically undermined by relentless disinformation stemming from corporate greed. The story of ivermectin shows that we as the public have misplaced our trust in the authorities and have underestimated the extent to which money and power corrupts. Had ivermectin been employed in 2020, when medical colleagues around the world first alerted the authorities to its efficacy, millions of lives could have been saved, and the pandemic with all of the associated suffering and loss brought to a rapid and timely end. Since then, hundreds of millions of people have been involved in the largest medical experiment in human history, mass vaccination with an unproven novel therapy. Hundreds of billions will be made by Big Pharma and paid for by the public. With politicians and other non-medical individuals dictating to us what we are allowed to prescribe to the ill, we as doctors have been put in a position such that our ability to uphold our Hippocratic Oath is under attack. At this fateful juncture, we must therefore choose. Will we continue to be held ransom by corrupt organizations, health authorities, Big Pharma, and billionaire sociopaths? Or will we do our moral and professional duty to do no harm and always do the best for those in our care? The latter includes urgently reaching out to colleagues around the world to discuss which of our tried and tested safe older medicines can be used against COVID, holding medical forums free of conflict of interest like this one, and banding together as health professionals to stand up to the medical tyranny that has been imposed on us and the public over the past year. To this end, I suggest we form a new World Health Organization, a health organization that represents the interests and well-being of the people, not corporations and billionaires, an organization focused on optimizing human health and potential, not contraception and population control, a people-centered organization. And never before has our role as doctors been more important, because never before have we been complicit in potentially causing so much harm. I ask all doctors here today to look into their hearts and remember their oath, so that we can move forward united in the protection of those we serve and with the greatest of courage. Thank you.
Well, that's Bath's Dr. Tess Laurie there. Very emotional end to her ivermectin conference, really accusing the multinational pharmaceutical industry of mass murder, effectively, and saying that the thing that breaks her heart is that so many doctors have been complicit.
Yeah, well, I hear what she says, and I've got no, you know, the pharmaceutical industry is part, very much part of the, you know, capitalist establishment that this show tries to hold to account. So I'm, you know.
The frontline COVID critical,
I hear what she says.
Critical care alliance, is, you know, is the, where many of these doctors have got together. I think it was started by Dr. Pierre Corey over in Canada, or in the States. No, in the States, I think. They do this thing, which I thoroughly recommend everybody like subscribes to, which is the every Thursday they do a weekly FLCCC podcast, which is really bringing us up to date on much of what's going on in the world, particularly to do with this very cheap and obvious cure. Well, it cures something like 80% of people that catch COVID, and it doesn't matter what you know, new variant you've got, that this nonsense that the BBC keep coming out with, that you've got a hold and there's a new variant, therefore we're all going to have to, you know, have another injection or panic or whatever, and the lies that are told there. But anyway, let's have a listen to this week's, just out yesterday, congressman, and he's not an American congressman, he's a congressman over in the Philippines, Mike Dispenser, talking about what's been going on in the Philippines, and comparing that to other parts of the world, the way that ivermectin was initially available, and then suddenly the vaccine companies came along, and the doctors are even being prosecuted for prescribing ivermectin now there. But anyway, here's a bit of a contrast between a couple of different countries and the way that they're dishing out ivermectin. India, for example, was dishing it out quite a lot, and then it stopped at the beginning of this year, and look what we've got now. So ivermectin seems to me is one of the key things to understanding how this pandemic could have been brought to a halt almost immediately, but the big pharmaceutical industry, the big pharma lobby, has prevented that by pulling on all its agents now infiltrating our government from its little Fourth Reich headquarters. Anyway, so this is the FLCCC, their weekly update, which comes out every Thursday. A little excerpt from that, Congressman Mike Dispenza from the Philippines.
We are seeing doctors individually on the ground. For instance, I'll talk about in the United States, we have what are called telehealth providers. And on our website of our organization, we've just listed those that do routinely prescribe ivermectin. Is there any such similar way of finding? So Jack, I'm not even going to ask you, because you're saying that everybody's using ivermectin in Zimbabwe. Mike, Congressman, you've already kind of said that I think once it starts to be compounded widely, I think the doctors will be freer to do it. How do you find a doctor right now to prescribe ivermectin in the Philippines?
Yeah, look, according to the situation right now is that, the event that we had for the distribution, the doctors were threatened that their licenses will be revoked. And so most of the doctors in the Philippines are afraid to do a prescription. Now, the production of, not like in the US or Canada, where you have compounding laboratories all over, in the Philippines, it's only in Manila. And these are like in one compounding laboratory, they can only produce 1,000 tablets a day, which is about, if you give 10 each, it's about 100 families.
Right.
So, yeah, it's actually, they're really killing the supply of ivermectin in the market. And that is the situation that we're faced with now in the Philippines. And it will continue. So now what you have here is many people getting it illegally. Some manufacturers are quietly producing. But the other day, I was just talking to a general who was in charge in looking into the ivermectin distribution. And he was telling me, Congressman, just stick to the guidelines that it has to be compounding and there should be prescription. But can you imagine, Dr. Corey, the limitation we have? We want to give it to as many people as we can. We want to talk about it. We want to educate people. But, the authorities are the ones limiting us.
I suppose the authorities really are being lent on. The doctors are being lent on by the authorities, but the authorities are being lent on by the pharmaceutical lobby.
It's quite possible. The pharmacies, what this pandemic, as you call it, has done is it's brought into sharp focus the way in which international healthcare is organized and how iniquitous that is on every level. And not in most basic ways, in some countries have actually got a public health system that functions and other countries simply haven't.
I increasingly talk about this Fourth Reich of a kind of corporatist empire of massive corporations who are actually working in lockstep together to dominate policy, and they're able to do this because they're so incredibly well funded, and they're also in league with the banksters. The banksters will invest in a company that can dominate a market, can dominate a country, but they won't invest in a company that plays by the rules.
Well, they make the rules. And of course, the behind all of what we've been going through in the last 18 months is the banking system becoming super profitable because of the bailouts which were brought in before the pandemic supposedly started in September 2019. And that's what we would have been talking about. Because it was the banking system went down the drain in 2019 before the pandemic started. Well, so people think that all of this government intervention to prop up the financial sector is because of the lockdowns and so on. In actual fact, it's had to do it anyway. And that's what we would have been talking about. But instead, everybody presumes that all the difficulties that we've got are just to do with health issues, whereas underlying that is the collapse of the banking system. We've now got the biggest asset bubble in history, which I think serious left and right wing economists all know there's only one end to that. It's a Minsky moment when it's going to come down. And then people are going to realize that in actual fact, capitalism is already dead. It died in 2008. It's now on life support. And when it dies, of course.
That thing is, that life support, the point is the life support is indefinite, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But the point is, yeah, but you can keep a bubble expanding, but at a certain point, you can't. Yeah. The modern monetary theory asserts that if you keep printing money, you can keep the system going. Now, in actual fact, what that is the technology of bubble blowing has now advanced to incredible lengths. All of these integrated financial markets with zero interest rates means that you can really blow an absolutely enormous bubble, which, of course, is incredibly profitable for the asset rich who are on the inside of the game. But, of course, at a certain point, I don't think there's much dispute about this across the spectrum in economics, it will crash. And when it crashes, there's going to be a societal collapse, a global societal collapse. Places like China, which are well placed to kind of ride that out, they will find a massive backwash over there. I mean, they've basically managed the pandemic better than everybody else. Their economy is growing, but of course their customers are still, you know, the rest of the world, and they are vulnerable to a crash, as is the Chinese economy itself, because of the
I don't think the Chinese are vulnerable to a crash.
They're pretty much
impervious, really.
May be an international
crash, but the thing is that they have got control of their state banks, and yes, it might have an impact, but they've got a firewall between the Western banking system and theirs.
They have.
The Russians are also prepared now to exit the SWIFT system at any time if they want
to.
So they are ready for an economic shockwave.
Well, they are, and they've been preparing for that economic shockwave for years. You know, for example, the Russians have been paying down their debts so that nobody can tell them what to do. But the problem is that if you see that the Western deep state is trying to bankrupt both Russia and China, which is an absolutely idiotic policy.
But it's bankrupting itself most of the people that live here in the process.
Yes, I know. And even if they were successful in bankrupting the Russian economy, which is the eighth biggest in the world, it would simply fall into a black hole and everybody would fall down with them, because the ripple effect from that would be enormous. So all of these sanctions, which are trying to bully these countries into line, they don't work, thankfully. There's countermeasures that you can take, but even if they did work, the result would simply be to crash anybody who wants to crash the Chinese economy to try and stop the Chinese getting ahead is it's a suicide mission. But of course, there's money to be made out of chaos. And that is ultimately the goal of the Western deep state. They're quite happy for everything to go to hell in a handbasket as long as they're making money.
There is a quote that springs to mind, and this is from David Rockefeller, who I met many moons ago, had a little one-to-one chat with him at a Bilderberg conference. I think it would be 2003 at the Palace of Versailles in Paris, or just outside Paris. And one of the things he said in his memoirs, which were published in 2002, was the following quote: "We are on the verge of a global transformation." Now, that global transformation, surely, is the corporations taking over from national governments.
Yes, but of course, making national governments their subservience. You won't get rid of national governments. They just become subservient to the corporate sector.
Well, see, they're being dissolved bit by bit. But anyway, that quote goes on.
Well, it depends which governments.
That quote goes on. He says, "We are on the verge of a global transformation. All we need is the right major crisis, and the nations will accept the new world order." That's from his 2002 memoirs.
Yeah, but the problem with that is that standing in the way of that is a very successful Chinese Communist Party with nuclear weapons, and a Russia which has got the best military on the planet, and they're not going to play ball.
I mean, he's quite good at selling this, actually. I must hand it to him. He died a couple of years ago, David, but he said, "I see a world of open borders, open trade, and most importantly, open minds." Although, you know, obviously by taking over the media, the minds are closed. But anyway, "a world that celebrates the common heritage that belongs to all the world's people. I see a world building on the emerging new model of European unity." Well, in a way, Brexit has put pay to all of this. This whole dream of some sort of, big love-in as a one-world government is out the window.
Yeah, and it always was out of the window. I've just pointed out that the Russians and the Chinese aren't playing ball any more than the Iranians. So the idea that there's just one... What's going on now is that the Western hegemonists want to continue the Western dominance of the global economy that has been for the last 500 years. But inevitably, in the long run, other people, China, for example, was a far more advanced country technologically than the West, but it basically fell behind because of various things we could go into. But ultimately, they were traditionally the most technologically advanced country, and they're going to take that role again. And of course, unless the Russians have got all of the raw materials in Siberia, so unless the Western powers can knock these two countries out of the game, then they are going to lose not the top spot, and they're terrified of that. It's actually not a problem. There's no reason why other people being good at stuff and getting ahead is a problem for you. Only if you've got an idea of domination that you've got, you know, it's somehow against nature for non-European or European origin countries to rule the roost. And of course, the real world is going to change. But what may well happen, of course, is in the attempt to prevent this perfectly natural development, the development of a multipolar world. I don't mean a new world order. Then we will actually destroy ourselves.
I mean, I would say actually it's the people who are trying to hijack the United Nations. And this is what I'm talking about with the banksters and the Fourth Reich, is that they've seen this United Nations for years getting in their way, being rather irritating, all sorts of, I mean, some parts of it, of course, they can buy up. But we're now in a situation that the UN has been starved and the World Economic Forum has done effectively a hostile takeover.
That's right. Well, I mean, you will find that both Putin and Xi Jinping
They were only ever going to get away with this if they could do it through consensus, surely. And they've decided, well, forget the consensus, we're going to do it anyway. And that's the problem.
In a way, the idea that we should all cooperate as one big team on planet Earth is not really so silly.
But they're not
prepared. The question is, who's going to give the orders?
Well, it looks like it's the World Economic Forum rather than the UN.
Yes, but I mean, the World Economic Forum had both Xi Jinping and Putin as Zoom participants this year, and without being rude or shouting and making rude gestures, they basically just said
no,
we're not doing any of this
and all that stuff. So the next step down, I suppose, from the World Economic Forum is this thing called the G7, which is this weird little organisation that we're supposed to believe is some kind of nice little club, but it's obviously all the Western powers. Isn't it really like a kind of invite-only club? And they've allowed, for example, India along to this G7. But if you're obedient, then you get an invite to the G7. Is it kind of invite-only world government?
Well, the G7 was set up in 1973, by Giscard d'Estaing. It was his idea as a French president, because they thought they needed to coordinate economic policy amongst the leading capitalist powers.
Well, they could have done that through the OECD or something.
No, the OECD is too wide. It's not, and it's too, I mean, the G7 was supposed to be, you know, we'll get the political
leaders. They can bang just a few political leaders' heads together rather than actually achieve some sort of consensus.
Yeah,
right.
That's right. And of course, for many years, it was only the G7. And of course, the other economics summit was set up by the New Economics Foundation, which I used to work for. And they, at every G7 meeting,
they were brilliant. I went to one in Birmingham and they were brilliant. Yeah. They would parallel those G7 conferences and do a brilliant critique of them. Some of the best people from the world who were doing a critique of the way the Western world was going.
I think we've probably got time, but we could quickly tell you a story about the 1991 G7 summit in London. I was working for the New Economics Foundation at the time. I was their East European desk officer. So I was charging around Eastern Europe talking to people and trying to drum up people to come to the our alternative conference. And I brought over Marek Grzelczyk, who's a Warsaw University economist, to talk about what was going on in Poland, for example. Anyway, Gorbachev was also coming over, and he was an invite to it. And the New Economics Foundation had somebody employed, whose name I've forgotten, who was to organise the whole conference, right?
So Gorbachev was coming to the G7,
But Grzelczyk was coming to our one.
Yeah, right, okay.
Anyway, so because I was in charge of the East European bit of it, I arranged for which East Europeans were going to come. But all the other visitors that were going to come from all over the world was organised by this guy whose name I've forgotten. It probably wasn't his proper name anyway. Anyway, just about a week before we were going to meetings, and he was saying, yes, I've invited so-and-so, they said they're coming, so we think it's all under control, we know what's happening, these people have all been invited, we know they're coming. And then he disappeared a week before the other economic summit, and he hadn't done anything. He'd not invited anybody. Nobody had been invited. So then everybody had to hit the phones to invite people like Wangari Maathai, who was a, you know, activist from Kenya that was very, you know, well known to the New Economics. And some of these people at a week's notice said, oh yes, I can come. So they had to, and of course that guy was a special demonstration squad guy or something similar. And what was extraordinary when I was talking to people at NEF was, they say, well, why would he do that? He must have mental health issues.
Maybe his name was...
And you feel like screaming from the rooms. No. He's a spy.
Yeah.
Don't you realise?
He was an infiltrator.
He's been paid by the government, by taxes that you pay, to sabotage what you're doing.
Yeah, so...
That's
maybe
the world
maybe
of
his
democratic
name, countries. Was his name Mark Kennedy, by any chance?
No, I can't remember what his name was, but as I say, his name was probably a false name in any case. And, of course, he had a perfect CV for doing this job. Hmm. Which was no doubt
and
made
some
up.
Very naive people employed him, although of course you can't really blame them. I mean, they're victims of a confidence trick.
Absolutely. And anyway, at the same time we go on about how we live in a democratic society, so that anybody can stand for election with an equal chance.
Okay,
meanwhile, the deep state is sabotaging all progressive movements.
Okay, so the G7 is finding its voice again, apparently, with China and Iran and Russia under fire. At the London meeting, representatives of the world's leading powers, most critical of China as its human rights abuses in Xinjiang and Tibet. So there you go, that's the G7.
Well, at one stage they extended the G7 to be the G8, if you remember, and the Russians were invited to join. And now, of course, they've been booted out because they're, you know, they're persona non grata. And at some points, people have suggested that maybe the Russians should be invited back in. And the Russian line is, we don't want to be part of this club. We want to work through the G20, which includes all of the leading developing countries, China, Brazil, India, South Africa.
Rounding this off then with a couple of looks at some stuff to do with COVID again, who is paying for the so-called Impartial Science Media Centre? Now, I've spoken to a journalist this week who is in the mainstream here in the UK. He knows he's getting a load of stuff from these people, and they're basically shoving a particular line. They've got, you know, contact details for most of the health correspondents around in the UK press, both national and regional, and they're rather pushy. They're called the Science Media Centre. There's a whole load of full-time journalists who are, PR people, who are pushing a lot of information onto journalists, which they're then repeating. But who funds them? It's called the sciencemediacentre.org. If you go onto their website, you'll find the list of funders, but the lowest ones are first. So I'll start with the highest ones. Over £30,000 donations to this Science Media Centre is the Wellcome Foundation and UKRI. I'm not quite sure who they are, some pharmaceutical business. Then between £20,000 and £30,000, funding them is GlaxoSmithKline, the Gatsby Charitable Foundation, AstraZeneca at £10,000 to £20,000. Crop Life International, Merck, who are a big pharmaceutical firm, and it goes on and on. BASF, Association of British Pharmaceutical Industry, giving between and £10,000. BASF, Bayer, who definitely are Fourth Reich businesses. BP International, the Chemical Industries Association, EDF Energy, GE Healthcare, Danone. These are the big corporations, Martin, which are funding the very powerful PR group called the Science Media Centre, which is pushing most of the discussions about COVID. It's not something that the journalists are necessarily finding out for themselves, but this is a whole kind of PR cut-and-paste exercise that's going on here, all paid for by Big Pharma.
Yeah, well, the big pharma business model is basically regulatory capture. You know, they pretend to
be
philanthropists.
But this isn't the regulators, this is the journalists.
No, I know, but they're all part of the same process, are they not, of dominating the narrative. What we should be doing is that pharmaceuticals should be developed in a not-for-profit context. just as they are in Cuba. Cuba has to develop all of its own pharmaceuticals for its own people, which they then use all over the world. Nobody makes a cent out of it. And that's the way to go.
Good old WikiSpooks have done an extension on their Bilderberg 2021 page, which is an even more people they've discovered are involved from the previous last 5-10 years of Bilderberg conferences in the playing major roles in the COVID-19 event. I mean, it's just too many to list, really. It's like so many. I will put a link up to, and I'll put the names up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But we're looking here at around about 30 Bilderbergers now they've got together, Martin. Some with unproven involvements, but very, very strong. For example, massive investments and owning businesses that are involved in these gene editing technologies, which have been used in the mRNA vaccines, these new types of mRNA vaccines. And of course, Peter Thiel as well. He's he's the founder of PayPal. These guys basically are, you know, the way I see Bilderberg now is that it's basically done its job. The people that the Bilderbergers wanted to are now in power in many parts of the world. Specific individuals are presidents and running countries and in all sorts of policy positions. And their investment bankers, their big corporate foundation funders, people like Bill Gates, obviously. He's a Bilderberger from 2010. He's an aggressive promoter of vaccines, commented in March 2020 that eventually we will need some digital certificates to show who has received or been tested for COVID-19 and when they have had a vaccine and who has received it. So he's stating that as a fact. And these Bilderbergers, Martin, it seems to me, are now running the show. Macron, of course, is one of them.
Yeah, well, what's happened is there's been a consolidation of power amongst Western elites. You know, it's around the neoliberal consensus, bank bailouts, etc. And of course, progressive forces have been in the West have been completely marginalised. Corbyn is almost like a Sitting Bull or some of the Indian chief who's trying to defend the traditional values of the labour movement, and he's just been squashed by a tank. But of course, what the problem they've got is that they didn't manage to conquer Russia in the 90s, and that they thought that by cooperating with the Chinese, that the Chinese would ultimately be subvertible as well. And it's not turned out to be the case. And so now they're getting increasingly desperate as we move towards the crash and possibly a war with Russia and China. And people say that's not going to happen. I say, why do you think it's not going to happen?
Well, as you know, Martin, I don't agree with you on China. I think Russia is genuinely independent. I think China is actually working very closely behind the scenes with some of these very powerful forthright corporations.
The Chinese and the Russians are now working together.
Well, they're both. I think both is going on. So there's a coming together of China and Russia. But there's also a coming together, I think, of some of these big, powerful Chinese companies with some of these Western elites here.
No. I think there was always a possibility. Both China and Russia are more dangerous than the Soviet Union and Communist China used to be, because they're actually inside the tent at the same time as being oppositional. And that's actually more problematic for them than them being outside the tent.
Well, one of the things I keep hearing about is this thing called the Wellcome Foundation. I mean, they were there they are, funding all this media spin that's going on right now, and the journalists being boxed in by these people, not just by the media spinners, but also by their managers and editors at the same time. Who are the Wellcome Foundation? Well, Jeremy Farrar is one of the top people on Sage, who's been making all these decisions. He's straight from the Wellcome Foundation. In fact, I think he still is the Wellcome Foundation, and he's making the decisions. He's the charge of policy. Thank you very much. But anyway, here is an extract from something called Q is for the Queen's Kinetic. It's actually about this part of the government which was privatised back in 2000, the Defence Evaluation Research Establishment, which designs all our new weapons for our armed forces. And something like two-thirds of that was privatised into this company called Kinetic. And this is a bit of a documentary about Q is for the Queen's Kinetic. It's all about that. But what I found so fascinating was that it goes into some of the roots of the Wellcome Foundation too, because it's all linked in. So anyway, this is about 5 minutes long. This is a little clip from that documentary. Q is for the Queen's Kinetic.
Henry M. Stanley, the explorer that is supposed to have famously said, Mr. Livingston, I presume, he went on numerous expeditions to Africa. And on the surface, he was supposed to be looking for David Livingston. But what we now conclude is that Stanley was a mercenary. He was a promoter, as was Purbright. And their one of their objectives was clearly to find poisons and cures in Africa, which Wellcome could then commercialize and distribute through the Wellcome laboratories. And at the same time, he was on a mission for the British East India Company to acquire the wealth of West Africa, especially the mining wealth in gold and diamonds. And he was closely teamed with the Rothschilds because he was involved with the setup of the British South Africa Company in Parliament, and we have the actual records of the parliamentary discussions on this, where they set up a corporation called the British South Africa Company, which Rhodes was the leader, at the same time as N.M. Rothschild, another great-grandson, along with Baron Purbright, funded the De Beers Diamond and Mining and Gold Company, and that became one of the chief funders of this British South Africa Corporation. And one of the most interesting aspects of this is they developed it so that it was a corporation that would run South Africa, not the British government, but this corporation. And this corporation would collect taxes, it would run its police force, and it would be independently operated. Now, that sounds very much like a fascist organization. And what we now see is that this was the origins of what we're going to call British imperial fascist corporatism. I know that's a lot of words. British imperial, meaning under the Queen. Fascist corporatism means the Queen is going to give special, Queen or King, give special positions to these corporations as long as they pay their fealty to the monarch and pay their taxes. And so at every point when members of Parliament tried to question this arrangement, they were shut down. And it was Henry de Worms, first Baron Purbright, that led the suppression of any criticism of this new British South Africa Company, which the Rothschilds were also invested in. So here we've got Henry Wellcome collecting drugs to be sent back to the UK. And Wellcome has got a facility through the trust on the Purbright property. And in addition to that, the explorer Stanley has a tomb, memorial, monument at the Purbright Church. So clearly, Baron Purbright, or Lord Purbright, as he was in earlier days, was their guiding light for the development of this reorganization of the British Empire around imperialist corporatism. And this explains how that British South Africa Company gained so much power in South Africa. And then we see, as Rhodes is getting older and sick, Lord Milner and John Buchan come in, and they press by the way, Purbright promoted both Boer wars. And in the Second Boer War, they set up a concentration camp. And as timing would have it, Douglas, we've just gotten a slew of documents from South Africa documenting the death of children in these war concentration camps. And they describe hideous treatment of these children and symptoms, which we're still getting medical people to tell us what these symptoms are. But they clearly believed they were being experimented with at the time. And these would have been those Wellcome medicine chests. So Henry Wellcome and the whole idea of using vaccines as a bioweapon goes way back to the late 1800s, early 1900s. And Henry Wellcome, and isn't it interesting that his trust would be the largest trust, second largest trust in the world today, giving grants out to researchers to further refine this strategy?
Well, how interesting how far back it goes. I had no idea about that, Martin, about the Wellcome Foundation's origins.
No, but at the same time, I mean, the hyper-imperialism of that era, the late 19th, early 20th century, is very similar to the world we live in now, with the US base of the corporations, you know, basically taking over that world domination role. But of course, at the same time, the, you know, other forces have emerged, particularly in the 21st century, which don't bode well for the future of rapacious corporate capitalism.
Well, no, that documentary on YouTube is called Q is for the Queen's Kinetic, and it's about the Purbright Institute as well, I believe, something about that as well. But it's about the way that much of the country was privatised in the 1980s. Quite a lot of it went to the Crown, Martin, directly to the Crown, controlled by the Crown. So it was privatised from, you know, whatever ministry was supposedly overseeing it, and the Crown's picked it up. And in
Kinetic was bought up by the Carlyle Group, wasn't it?
Yeah, but the Queen is a major shareholder.
Yes. So in other words, but I mean, and you know, the relationship between the royal family's finances and corporate capitalism is pretty opaque,
isn't it? Interesting.
But it's at the same time,
you can privatise it, but the Queen's got most of the shares.
Well, at the same time, the real point is
she's privatised it to herself, really. I mean, that's what's going
on. When we used to have what the French call les trente glorieux, the 30 years of successful capitalism. Large chunks of the economy were actually run by the state, as you said earlier. Things like railways, water supply, etc. And in actual fact, as the Chinese have realised, that is the efficient way to do it. Because what we've got now is profiteering on these monopolistic concerns that are the basic infrastructure of the society.
Well, I mean, it does make you wonder.
And that means that the in actual fact, you're rising the costs for genuine entrepreneurial activity.
But what we're dealing with here is just a predator class. They're actually predating on us, you know?
They are. And of course, the problem with being a predator is if you kill the host, then you don't make any more money. And of course, that's the problem with the corporate capitalist revolutionary policies.
At least if you kill the host, you don't get any Black Lives Matter demonstrations. You don't get any Kill the Bill demonstrations or lockdown demonstrations, do you, if you've killed the host?
Well, the killing the host is killing the whole of human society. And of course, we're you know, whatever you think about climate change, we have and things like soil loss, species loss, what's happened in the developing world in the last year is that 20 years of potential progress has been snuffed out, and we've also got the potential for major conflict. And of course, if you live in places like Syria, the last 10 years have just been purgatory.
Well, what about depopulation and eugenics? Do you think this is really going on?
There's clearly a wing of the ruling class in the West that is a eugenicist. There's no doubt about it. I mean, basically, they want the natural resources in Africa. They don't want the people. And, that's the reality. The same with Israel, for example. They want the oil in the Golan Heights, but they don't want the Arab population that lived there.
Surely this is largely a British thing, eugenics, and an American.
Well, it was very common.
Before Adolf Hitler made it a bit unfashionable.
Yes, well, what happened in the 1940s, because of the Nazi ideology, eugenics became, rather unrespectable. But up to that point, it was right across the spectrum that people believed that we should actually improve the human stock.
Great thinkers like George Bernard Shaw.
And H.G. Wells and the socialists in Sweden and so on. But of course, it was, and of course, Winston Churchill, who was a racist. And he believed in, we shouldn't be allowing, inferior people to breed and so on. And it's only because of what happened in World War II that became unrespectable.
Well, maybe some of that is...
But underlying all of it, it's still there.
Well, maybe, partly because the generation that understood and lived through World War II are now almost completely died off, that it's having a sort of quiet resurgence.
Well, I think it's been the default position of the ruling class forever. And they're just becoming more open about it.
Anyway, there's a interesting documentary, another one called The Fall of the Cabal, which was taken off of YouTube. It's on, I think, BitChute. But then the woman who did it, Janet Ossebard, did another version. It was so successful that she thought, oh, I'll do a sequel to The Fall of the Cabal, which has got quite a lot in its part six about the UN Population Fund and you should really call it the Depopulation Fund. So let's have a listen to a short clip from that.
Of course, the United Nations Population Fund denies being involved in forced abortions, but according to its own documents, it donated more than $100 million to China's population control program. It financed a $12 million computer complex, specifically to monitor the population program. It provided the technical expertise and personnel that trained thousands of Chinese population control officials. In China, abortions have been used as a weapon of mass destruction. Hundreds of millions of lives have been exterminated. The UN Population Fund was complicit in China's population control policies from the beginning. They did not only turn a blind eye to abuses, but helped facilitate and fund them. The UN Population Fund funded birth restrictions. It funded forced abortions. It funded China's coercive family planning bureaucracy. They also defended China's actions. Congressman Christopher Smith, co-chairman of the Congressional Executive Commission on China, 2017. One result of the one-child policy that we never hear the UN about is the surge in female infanticide that has now resulted in a disastrous sex ratio of 115 boys to every 100 girls. Female infanticide means that parents actually kill their baby girls. China has a cultural preference for boys, so the baby girls are killed. Do you know what that does to a parent? If you do, it will not surprise you that China has the highest female suicide rate in the world, and it is the only country listed where the number of suicides among women surpasses that of men. Any sympathy from the UN? No. On the contrary, the United Nations Population Fund presented China with a UN award for the most outstanding population control program.
So that's Janet Osterberg there, Martin, looking at the UN. It's almost as if, well, maybe the World Economic Forum don't need to take them over because these UN programs are already controlled by vested interests.
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole question of population is a wider question, isn't it? I mean, what is the carrying capacity of planet Earth and all these other questions get raised? And, of course, in India, you've got a similarly poor ratio between male and female births, because with modern technology, they can tell whether a fetus is male or female.
And well, that's what they were doing in China, yeah.
Yeah, but of course, in India, you've got similar issues.
So, do you think that there's? I mean, they've sort of made this whole idea of we've got to reduce the world's population respectable.
Well, I think the idea that we've got to have some kind of policy to reduce the amount of people on the earth in the long run is not, you know, I think...
See, that translates down into saying, oh, right, well, you can't have any kids
No, well, yes, because in actual fact, when China is a communist country with the limited resources, decided that that's what they were going to do. And in actual fact, they've now opened the policy up, that they're trying to actually increase the population. Don't forget, before that, when Mao Zedong was in power, he encouraged people to have as many babies as possible, because he needed lots of male soldiers for the human wave attacks that they carried out in the Korean War, where they just kept coming, even though they were being massacred by machine gun fire and so forth.
Well, people would say the same thing about today with the 35 million or so extra blokes that they've got in China, is that they've got themselves there a massive spare population that they could go into an army and are expendable.
Well, in actual fact, the real problem for the Chinese economy now is that they've opened up the one-child policy so people can have more than one child. But in actual fact, because of the cultural changes that have taken place in China, same thing happened in Japan, and same thing's happened in Italy. Lots of countries end up having not a replacement population.
It's a problem, isn't it? That you've got some of these regimes that, okay, so they don't allow religion in China. You know, they don't really because they appoint, for example, Christian leaders are appointed by the Chinese. Yeah,
they try to control.
And
everything.
The same with Muslims. There are problems. Examples is yeah. that they have to be approved by the state. You know, yeah. So this isn't really religious freedom at all. And yet they've got their own kind of religion, which is like, oh, we want a load of soldier ants.
Well, I mean, the fact that you know, you can. There's a very good blog that people can read. It called "Here Come China." By Godfrey, I can't remember the second name, but if you look it up, Here Comes China, it comes out every week, and it's got detailed stuff in there about what modern China is all about. And it's much more complicated than the outside world thinks. I would love to visit China. I don't suppose I shall ever
Godfrey
have the opportunity.
Godfrey Roberts?
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay, so
and if he's obviously quite pro-Chinese, but he's also knowledgeable about what goes on there, because there's an awful lot of huffing and puffing and not very lot of concrete information.
And so they've given up on the soldier ants now, have they?
Well, they haven't. No, they basically Xi Jinping has said we've got to be prepared to fight because they know that 9/11 was an inside job carried out by the U.S. security forces.
They're not aborting the girls, is what I mean. Well, the babies.
Well, what's actually happening now is that they've encouraged people to have more children. But they've reached the point of middle class contentment where they don't want more children. Well, I mean, the same thing happened in Japan a generation ago.
Actually, this social engineering is pervasive in the West as well, isn't it? Massively,
it is.
And that happens through the media.
But ultimately, what you find, there is something which they call the demographic transition, and that means that once you reach a certain level of economic development, people, for their own reasons, do not have the same number of children they used to have.
So if we don't want to have a population explosion, let's just treat people decently.
That's right. The answer to this is to develop countries, give people options. In Kerala, in southern India, where they
give them food, give them shelter, give them water.
In Kerala, in southern India, where the Communist Party have just been re-elected overwhelmingly, they have a voluntary one-child policy. And they also give everybody education, free education. They carried through a land reform, so everybody's got a bit of land if they want a bit of land. And people are basically they're not forced to have one child, but they're given a strong encouragement.
So they're not. So I mean, all this stuff about giving people, making sure people have got the basics to live, meaning that, you know, there's not some sort of crisis where they have to have loads of kids or where they're just having a bad life, basically. I find it shocking to see that just this week they've announced in Somerset that they're going to take away water and sanitation from the traveller sites in Somerset. We're seeing the same sort of thing happening here. So it's all back to normal again, with everyone that's been made homeless and forced to live in a vehicle, as well as people who have traditionally lived in vehicles. The travellers are all being hammered again. No water for them, no sites for them, and they're about to be criminalised by Priti Patel. So this doesn't sound like we're very civilised here either.
No, well, I mean, the world, I mean, Xi Jinping made a speech some while ago where he said, well, the world is in turmoil. This is the biggest inflection point since World War II. And if you know anything about history, you know that it's unlikely to be pleasant what we're going to go through next.
Okay, so
it's going to be tough.
In India, things have been getting pretty rough for people generally. We never mind this extra wave of COVID, which seems to have been largely caused by Big Pharma pressurising their government to stop the use of ivermectin, which last week apparently was for the first time being used again in order to stop the spread of COVID over there. But more importantly, in many ways, there's been big changes by Modi in India about over farming. The state for decades has been supporting farmers, giving them guaranteed prices for their products. All that's going, and the whole thing is being taken over, and a lot of land is being taken over there by massive agricultural firms. So there was a little clip I got. I didn't get the guy's name, but he's from the Punjab. Here he is talking about what's happening in India now. With the Sikhs and Muslims are being campaigned against, really, by what is a Hindu leader, Modi, supposedly, and how he thinks, this guy thinks, that they will be eventually starve the world to death like this. And that's why the Indian farmers are so angry.
What's happening is the Indian government, they have a plan to take over the food supply completely. So, and this Indian government, if you have to realize what this Indian government stands for, it stands for a Hindu supremacy or a Hindu state. And they want to use the food supply or the control of the food supply to implement their fascist ideology throughout, because India is a federal structure. And to completely take over that federal structure and implement this idea of a Hindu state, what they want to use the food supply. And the people and all the activists have realized that. And when the agitation was started in Punjab, what we showed the people of entire India, there is no need to fear this fascist regime. I know 400 plus people have died in this agitation. There have been shootings by the police. They've been tortured to death. They've been raped by the police. And the police has used utmost force against these protesters, but still today the protesters are there and they're still surrounding Delhi and they're still struggling, and they're going to surround the parliament in coming days and to bring the government to its knees. But what we have to realize, they are fighting to survive. And if the food supply, you see,
how exactly are they taking over the food supply?
Food supply is simply at the moment the current provision is that food supply is sold to government and public services where they store it. But at the moment, they want the private sector to take over their supply chain. So once that supply chain goes into... So we are talking about people who are committed to eugenics in India, who are committed to this concept of caste system. When we are thinking of caste system, we must think of it as a political system of subjugation and slavery. This system has been in that region and enslaving that people for thousands of years. They want to implement it to a degree that there would be nothing, no opposition whatsoever. So this is the last resistance, the people who are protesting and surrounding Delhi. And if that resistance fails, the food supply goes into the hand. Because what they're trying to do is the private companies just want to buy the entire grain and rice. So if entire grain and rice is bought by these private companies, they can easily store away and stop it from going into the public service. And that's where the main struggle is. And they have done this in the past. We have to realize, in the time of World War and World One and Two, they did exactly the same system. They controlled the food supply and they stopped the main food stores, especially wheat and rice, because they are the main staples. And they stored them away and did not let it into public circulation. And that led to mass famine, which they blamed on everybody.
So what the current government regulation does at the moment is it holds it in case of time of famine.
Yeah, so there's a supply chain set up at the moment. Supply chain is set up. It's running very nicely. So at least people get... So if there's enough production, people can buy food. So current provision, it's not the best system, but at least the food supply is getting to the people. But if these private corporations take over the system, it's not just a fear. We know these people who are buying these corporations. They have direct links to Bill Gates and Melinda Foundation, and they want to control the food supply and mass murder people. And they have openly said that's what they want to do. We must understand in the West that caste system is a political system of slavery. And I would like to add, I think a lot of people miss when we talk about Preeti Patel, Rishi Sunak and Alok Sharma. These are cabinet ministers. They want to overthrow the British system and implement that same political system here as well. So once we, just like Pierce said, there is the same attempt being made in Britain to take over the food supply, and these are very dangerous attempts.
Is there no way that small...
So, very dangerous times, he says there, and dangerous people. Rishi Sunak, Priti Patel, wanting to take over the food supply, Martin.
Well, I think that's a bit strange, because in some respects, the food supply here has already been privatised in ways that it hasn't been in India. But, yes, it's an existential struggle for the Indian farmers. And, of course, there are a lot of them. One of the things that crashed the Doha round of the World Trade Organization was that the Indian government of that era wasn't willing to open up Indian farming to multinational penetration because there's so many people who still make a living on the land in India. And of course,
well, they're trying to shut the government down basically in India, and they've said that if we fail in this, that's it.
Well, I mean, they're obviously determined. What's interesting is in the Modi phenomenon he's basically a corporate fascist. There's no doubt about it. I mean, the guy's quite right about that. But ultimately, of course, India is a very big, complicated place, and the BJP are not necessarily going to be in power forever.
Well, so yes, but having said that, I mean, if they control the food supply, they're going to be controlling the country, surely.
Yeah, well, that's what they want to do, but of course they're provoking resistance. And one of the things that Modi has been saying is that the farmers are all Sikh terrorists, for example. So they're trying the divide and rule tactic and all the rest of it, because Punjab's got a big Sikh
anyway, we have population. By the way, a winner is confirmed for the Avon Somerset Police and Crime Commissioner. The Conservative Mark Shelford, who was on this show a few weeks ago, is the new Police and Crime Commissioner for Avon and Somerset. He beat Labour's Kerry Barker by 15,000 votes. Mark Shelford, 161,000. Kerry Barker, 146,000. So it'd be interesting to see if he follows through on what we were saying earlier, which is the prosecution of these alleged... well, I don't know if I even need to say alleged now. The law lords have ruled on it. These Lloyds Bank Business Support Unit people who've taken farms off of so many. We didn't have time for Dr. John Lee, which is a pity. Maybe we could just have a couple of minutes of him. Let's have a listen to him now. He was on Talk Radio early this week, and I'll put a full version of this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, and I'll put it up as a YouTube too, because he was so particularly good. But it's too long, really. It's quarter of an hour. Let's just have a listen to the first couple of minutes of Dr. John Lee.
It's difficult to know where they see the exit point coming, isn't it, really? I mean, yeah. It's pretty clear, I think, to almost everybody that they're now being far too cautious for far too long. Mm. And, you know, what they won't do is to engage in a proper conversation in public about why. I think the reason, my take on it, is that I think the reason is that they're enthralled to the precautionary principle, which is sort of better safe than sorry principle, yeah. Which would be okay if it was true. But of course, if what you're doing is more harmful than what you're trying to prevent, it all becomes a bit of a nonsense.
Well, it does. And also, they seem to only look at one level of harm. You know, you've talked about the excess deaths in the video, many of which you can attribute not just to COVID, but to also people who are dying of loneliness, people dying because they can't get treatment for other problems. And in the end, they seem to only be looking at the harm caused by COVID rather than the harm actually caused by the lockdown.
Yeah, well, this has been a problem throughout, is that if the government's going to set itself up as the nation's doctor, they ought to follow medical principles. And one of the key, most basic medical principles is first do no harm. Mm. And the thing is, in order to do that, you have to do two things. First of all, you have to do a risk-benefit assessment of the treatment you're giving. And secondly, you have to look at what's happening in the round. So if you focus obsessively on one thing, which is COVID, and you ignore all other possible health effects and harms of what you're doing, obviously you won't get the right answer. And they've been doing that from day one, as you said.
Well, indeed. And so when you see Messrs. Hancock, Dominic Raab, Boris Johnson and others talking about, you know, having to wait and having to see what the evidence is and check the data and all of that, they don't seem to have moved at all from what was set out back in January. And when things could not have been more different.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, it's a good example, isn't it? The politicians doing exactly the opposite of what they're saying in public. So yes. They told us at the beginning it was going to be data, not dates. And clearly what they meant is going to be dates, not data.
So that was a little excerpt of that, and I'll put a full copy of that. It was a fascinating interview with this guy, Dr. John Lee, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Martin, a lot of people now saying that we should be well open by now. You know, one of the days last week, we only had one person who died with COVID, not even of COVID, with COVID.
Well, if they'd locked down at the right time last year, we'd already be out of the woods. But because we didn't...
Well, what he's saying is we are out of the woods. Well, but we're just pretending we're not.
Okay, I'm not going to argue with a doctor. I'll just point out that it's pretty clear that when people like, for example, yourself and Julia Hartley Brewer and Toby Young were saying, as we went into Christmas, there is no second wave, they were just wrong. And if we'd locked down properly, that Eat Out to Help Out has clearly
Martin,
we are still in lockdown. We've had four lockdowns.
If
we should have had one lockdown.
If you're going to say I was wrong, that's fine. But I think was going on there was that we had a what they call a case-demic, lots and lots of cases. But the virus,
death rate in January was the worst death rate for any month of the crisis.
Are we talking about
January 2021?
Yeah. Are we talking about the people? All these people died with COVID or of other
all
of
right.
other causes.
So you're trying to dispute the fact that they died of COVID? I think you're clutching at straws. The decisions about lockdown in this country, and there's probably not going to be an inquiry now, especially if the Tories do well in this election. But there should be an inquiry, and lots of the relatives of people who died are demanding an inquiry. And
well,
if we're going
course,
to end the lockdown,
there should be an inquiry.
The decision not to lock down in February should be looked at.
We should be looking
the decision
at,
to open up
Martin,
later.
You're shouting, being
because,
silly and shouting again.
That's because you're trying
what
to talk
about,
over
what
me,
about
Tony?
John Hopkins and all the modelling that was proved to be completely wrong?
It wasn't proved to be completely wrong, Tony. The fact is that the modelling has actually proved to be right, and the political decisions that have been made by Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson basically said, we're not going to lock down, I'll have thousands of...
You have confidence in people like Ferguson, Neil Ferguson, then, do you?
No, Tony, I've got confidence in Jacinda Ardern. I've got confidence in Xi Jinping. They've got no COVID in either of those countries. Their economies are back up and running. In Southeast Asia, in Taiwan, all of these countries did it right. We did it wrong. We did it wrong partly because a lot of people won't accept that they made wrong decisions earlier in the crisis because they think there's a trade-off between the economy and a lockdown. There isn't a trade-off between the economy and
lockdown.
This is the difference. If you lock down properly at the beginning, the economy comes back.
But you don't necessarily, Martin, you don't necessarily need to lock down when you're dealing with something which is only...
If it's a biological weapon used against the Chinese...
You're going to let me finish a sentence. If we're dealing with something which is only a little bit more dangerous than a bad flu season, why do you need to have a lockdown at all?
You're still coming back with this stuff about it's just a flu, like Bolsonaro was saying.
I'm not saying it's flu. I'm saying it's a bit worse than the flu, yeah?
And if it's a biological weapon, as we've covered in previous weeks...
And you're blocking... You think it's right that they didn't use ivermectin, do you?
The ivermectin argument is completely separate, Tony.
No, it isn't.
No, it isn't, because
it was blocked. Both that and chloroquine were deliberately blocked, so they couldn't
I've
be
got
used.
No problem with that argument at all. But your argument that lockdowns were wrong is wrong.
Well, it is wrong. If you're going to use these things, you don't need to do a lockdown.
Yeah, the Chinese don't even have to bother with ivermectin. Their economy is booming. They've had 4,000 deaths out of a billion people. We, on the other hand, have had 150,000 deaths or whatever it is, and the economy has taken a bigger hit. There's actually a trade-off you could put into a graph between lockdown and what happens with the economy. Some countries are going to do very well in that one. New Zealand and China will be at the top.
You're shouting and shouting again. You don't need to shout. We can hear what you're saying without shouting.
Yeah.
I'd just like to correct something you were saying last week about Finland, that they had a solid lockdown. No, they didn't. Finland had travel restrictions, but no lockdown in the same sense that we had. It would be nice if you could find a source to back up your claims, and fine, we can have a look at that. But as far as I've been able to find out, Finland only had some travel restrictions and closure of schools, public places and restaurant closures, but they did not restrict people's movements at all in the way that the UK did. So you said they had a solid lockdown, and they didn't.
The point is that Norway and Finland did much better than Sweden, who had a much softer lockdown. We have done particularly badly because we've had to have longer lockdowns for more time, which has done more damage to the economy because we didn't get it right from the get-go.
Some of the things that you're shouting about, I'm trying to point out, you're just not right.
Yes, but you've got a computer in front of you and you've got all the time in the world to find...
No, I haven't all the time in the world. I'm just pointing out that you're saying that they've had a solid lockdown and did it properly, but actually they didn't.
No, they didn't do it properly. The people who did it properly were in New Zealand and China, that's right, but they're not in Europe. So we just compared with the other Europeans. And, of course, the other places that have done very badly is the United States and Brazil.
I can tell you, your views seem to be very, very aligned with that of Bill Gates, because he thinks they did a very good job there. Because most of those countries now have got very concentrated and concentrated vaccine programs. And they're now looking at making the vaccine passports essential for getting in and out of the country. This is what Bill Gates wanted.
Well, Bill Gates might be right about something. I'm not saying anything about that. The point is, Tony, that if you've got the way to deal with this is A, as you say, don't turn your nose up at existing drugs which may deal with it. You don't have to basically find new stuff.
It does. And the other thing is, it's not a might deal with it. It does deal.
Well, okay, I'm not going to argue about that because I'm not a doctor. But the other thing is, as an economist, a solid lockdown at the beginning was absolutely the correct decision for China, and it's been vindicated 100%. And of course, we didn't do that, which is why we're still.
But it's also conditioning people to live in a police state.
It's a police state already, but they're at war with the deep state in the West.
So we're just going to have to shrug our shoulders and say, "Well, we live in a police state. We're just going to have to do as we're told."
No, maybe we had better take up arms and go and rescue Julian Assange. I'll speak to you when we finish this discussion.
I'm not talking about arms. I'm not actually talking about arms. No, but I think it'd be nice to see him sprung from jail. I think we'd all agree. Anyway, what do you think, if any, this relation of all of this to the whole climate change agenda? Because there's a lot of people pointing out, actually, during the lockdowns, there were hardly any planes flying. There still are hardly any planes flying. But I'm afraid it hasn't made anywhere near enough of a difference. We still need to have all these climate change measures. It hasn't made a blind bit of difference at all.
I think that leaving aside whether climate change is or isn't a thing, the World Economic Forum and the deep state in the West want to use it as part of a strategy. You know, they're trying to get young people who are basically anti-capitalist to put all of their energies into climate change as if that's the only issue. The real issue is the banking system and the war, the nuclear weapons, which are going to kill us. In the 1980s, when we were eyeball to eyeball with the Soviet Union as a 20-something, we were very well aware that we could easily just go over the edge. And in 1983, we very nearly did. And all the rhetoric of we've got to stand up to the Soviet Union had everything on a knife edge. And if you remember when the Korean airliner flew over Sakhalin Peninsula and was shot down by the Russians, that was all a provocation by the Americans, as was uncovered by R.W. Johnson, who is a politics professor at Magdalen College. And basically, they're doing exactly the same thing now as they were doing then. They're trying to provoke both the Russians and the Chinese, and any mistake now could lead to a nuclear war, which will make climate change.
What about the climate thing, though? Because that's also surely being used as a way to raise new, all sorts of implement new loads of new taxes.
Well, what's interesting about the NGOs in this country is that they've not bought into this cap and trade thing. That is basically a capitalist solution for a capitalist problem. If you want to reduce the amount of coal, oil and stuff you use, you've got to make a plan to do that. And it's not going to be done by changing relative prices.
Well, it does seem to me that the massive oil companies, the BPs, the Shells, you know, the energy firms of the world have just decided, right, well, we're going to actually change things and we're going to be controlling the outcome of it. We are going to be in control of the new electric technologies, the wind technologies, the solar technologies. And isn't it fascinating how they could have a solar panel on every house in the country, but they don't. The solar panels have gone to individual landowners and farmers. And so people, ordinary individual people, are not being able to benefit from it anymore.
Well, in China, they've been developing all of these new technologies because don't forget they've got a real problem. They've got no oil. So they have to import their oil, just like the Japanese do. So they've got a very strong interest.
From Iran, maybe?
They're inviting from Iran, yes, of course. Yes, but of course, the point is that it has to go through the Strait of Malacca, right by Singapore is, and of course the West can cut off their oil supply at any time. So they're trying to find other ways to get oil in. But of course, what they're also doing is building oil pipelines from Siberia into China, which will not be able to be knocked out. But the Chinese position on alternative technologies like this is that we want to develop them as quickly as possible, and we want to be the leaders in these, you know, electric cars and all the rest of it. But we're going to have to carry on using coal and oil because we haven't got any option in the short run.
Okay, well, what about the science of climate change? Is it a real science, or is it a science that's been bought?
Well, I am actually agnostic about this. I think that in any case, all of those people who are active on climate change, whether climate change is a thing or not, we've got to stop using the world's resources as if they're just an endless, it's just an endless lucky bag. And that means that we've got to start planning everything we do to try and make sure that we're not destroying the environment.
Well, one thing that really frustrates and annoys me is we had all this stuff in the 1960s of the railways being shut down by Beeching, the guy that was behind the British atomic bomb, or he was the metallurgist in designing that. He had known nothing about railways, but he knew how to keep his mouth shut. And so he was used to close the railways down. And then, of course, we all got to buy a car because the Americans didn't want us to be pumping out North Sea oil without our own domestic market. So we had to open our domestic market before they'd let us do that in oil. And so we all got cars. We're all dependent on cars. We've got horrible privatised public transport everywhere, massively expensive rail fares, etc. And so, you know, you're forced to buy a car, and then you're told, oh, by the way, you're a terrible person. We're going to have to tax you now for driving around. So there's a whole load of stuff in this that, I find completely
logical. Yeah, even if climate change is a thing, the people that claim they're going to solve the problem, the World Economic Forum, are the last people who should be trusted to do anything.
Anyway,
they are the problem.
One person is very much not agnostic on climate change, or was not agnostic, is our fifth of our conspiracy classics tonight, a little extract from that, and I'll put the full version of it up on our show page. And the guy's name is Christopher Booker. He used to write for the Daily Telegraph, and here's a little extract looking at the science of the international scientists who are making these decisions about whether climate change is real and how dangerous it is or not. And here he is speaking at the Glastonbury Symposium about 6-7 years ago in a talk called Global Warming, Real or False?
Now, the year when it really all took off was 1988. It was in that year that an obscure little group of scientists in Geneva were given authorization to set up a thing called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change under the auspices of the UN and its World Meteorological Organization and another bureaucratic body, which actually plays quite an important part in this story, although I won't be mentioning it again, called the United Nations Environment Programme. Anyway, 28 guys sat around a table, they were all men, and they set up the IPCC. But at the same time, elsewhere, completely unconnected to what they were doing in Geneva, there was a tremendous excitement, particularly in America, set off in particular by a chap called Dr. Jim Hansen, who worked for NASA, who appeared before a Senate committee, sweated profusely, pointed out that it was probably the hottest day ever in the history of the world, and certainly 1988 was the hottest year in the history of the world. And he set off a huge, great media hysteria. The media absolutely loved this disaster story, disaster movie story. The environmentalist groups were already getting, like WWF, Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, were all also getting, suddenly got very, very excited by this, or distressed by the thought that we were facing this potential catastrophe. Politicians started to move in on it. The first one, of course, who became famous more through this than anything else was Al Gore in the States, who was sitting in that room when Jim Hansen was sweating away on the witness stand. And over in this country, Mrs. Thatcher got very excited by it. Although, as I pointed out in one of my columns recently, she later completely reversed her views. But she, in fact, did set in train a number of things which were to have huge influence on this whole story that we're involved in. One of which was to give large sums of money to the head of the Met Office, a chap called Dr. John Howden, who's been a very key figure in this story, because not only was he then put in charge of giving the money to start a thing called the Hadley Centre for the for climate, studying climate change down in Exeter, but he was also the first chairman of the scientific working groups in the United Nations IPCC, the IPCC, which has played such a hugely important part in this story. In fact, he was in that room in Geneva, which I talked about, and the people that were with him were all already firmly committed to the idea that global warming was happening, that CO2 and other greenhouse gases were the cause of it, i.e. it was man's activity. And they set about writing the first of a series of reports which have been kind of like a holy Bible for the whole orthodoxy of the global warming movement ever since. Now, they relied for their main evidence to support their theory on very comprehensive, complex and expensive computer models. And those computer models, which, as I say, have, with the IPCC itself, have played an absolutely central part in this story, they were essentially programmed to show how, as CO2 levels rose, which they were doing, temperatures must inevitably follow. So, with extraordinary speed, this idea, this terrifying idea, seized the politicians of the world. And the first IPCC report came out in 1990. 2 years later, we had that huge conference called the Rio Summit in Rio de Janeiro, when 20,000 people came from all over the world, including 108 heads of state and heads of government. It was massive. The world had never seen anything like it before. And that led on 5 years later, that was the whole point of the Rio conference, was to set up the framework for the famous Kyoto Protocol of 1997, which was the first international treaty which committed the nations of the world, particularly the developed nations of the world, to cutting their emissions of carbon dioxide. So up to this point, the theory seemed only too plausible. CO2 was rising, temperatures were rising, and everyone in positions of power was having to listen to this, and many of them were beginning to work out what should be our response. So, at that point, that's where the first phase of the story, and when you think about it, within less than 10 years, they've come from virtually nowhere to having this quite unprecedented global treaty. There was just one central drawback which worried the guys in charge of the IPCC, and really there are remarkably few of them. We often get told the IPCC represents a consensus of the world's top 2,500 climate scientists. It's nothing of the kind. Most of the people who write those IPCC reports, most of them actually aren't scientists at all. A lot of them are economists, sociologists, they're even representatives of WWF and Greenpeace. There are a group of scientists right at the heart of the IPCC who have been extraordinarily influential, and one of the places where they are particularly situated is a place called the Climatic Research Unit in East Anglia, which has been in the news a bit lately and which I shall refer to later. However, there was, as I say, one real problem they had with their theory, because it was all very well to say that temperatures going up, CO2 going up, unprecedented, but what were they to do about all the evidence which up to that point had been accepted, that at quite a number of times since the emergence of the Earth from the last ice age, about 12,000, 30,000 years ago, there was plenty of evidence to suggest that world temperatures were probably higher than they were in the late 1990s. In fact, for a very long period, the so-called Holocene optimum, for about 3,000 years, they were much higher. And the temperature had climate, as we know. The one thing about climate is it always changes. And temperatures go up and down, and there have been periods of warming, periods of cooling. One of the most interesting ones, which, because it's in a way the most recent example of a warm period, the so-called medieval warm period, was one which took place for 300 or 400 years, about 1,000 years ago. And there was a problem here. Because, as you know, in the Middle Ages, when Glastonbury Abbey was being built, there weren't many SUVs going around. People weren't sort of failing to turn off their TV sets at night. And in other words, if the world was warmer for 200 or 300 years in Norman and early medieval times, then what was so new about the fact that temperatures were rising a bit now?
So that's Christopher Booker there. Bless him. A fascinating guy, very good writer, and I'll put the long version of that, which is about an hour and a bit long, from the Glastonbury Symposium, I'm sure Andy won't mind, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, sound engineer Dave Bozanko. To be included on my weekly email circulation list, do email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. You'll find that address on the contact tab at thisweek.org.uk. Just a quick reminder that my paperback book, Martin Bormann and the Bilderbergers, is out. The title is The Traitors of Arnhem. So it's all about, well, it's actually the connections between the Arnhem Battle the Red House meeting, which took place a month before that battle, and the deals which were being done between the Nazis and the Allies at the end of the Second World War, and how they sacrificed thousands of men's lives and sent them loads of them to be prisoners in order to buy time at the end of the war for the Nazis to squirrel away their wealth and to do various deals. So treacherous Brits, not the Americans. The Americans fought very hard and very well, but at that battle in September 1944, the British leaders, many of them, were actively working to lose the battle and to sacrifice their men. Quite shocking, really. And the result 10 years later, was the inauguration of the Bilderberg meetings in Oosterbeek, in the same place in the Witch's Cauldron, 10 years after, with Prince Bernhard, who'd been instrumental in the sacrifice of the British men, chairing the very first ever Bilderberg meeting. And that carried on. And as I said earlier in the programme, it looks to me now as if the Bilderberg's little plan is complete. They've got their little agents in running these various countries. And their plan is unfolding. COVID, as we heard from Manfred Petrisch from All Smoke and Rears, he believed anyway that this is their little plan. Maybe he's right. So if you've got a site or a story that you'd like to share, you can think there's anything I've missed or have got a correction, please do email me with a link or two, or even a scan of what you have, if possible. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find Not the BCFM Politics Show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. You'll find links on there also to the book, The Traitors of Arnhem, just out in paperback, or you can get that also. Maybe the quickest way is go to bilderberg.org, the website www.bilderberg.org, and you'll find a link there to buy a copy of it. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling, just like many others, like Craig Murray, etc. And about 4 years ago, all of our retweets and whatever, the views went right down, plummeted over the space of just a few days. And I'm also asking people to write to Ofcom if they want to about the political removal of our show by the Blairite Bristol Mayor, Marvin Rees's longtime chum, BCFM station manager, Patrick Hart. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream here, and also over Sunday lunch at camberleysradioquk.com. Do please make recordings of the stream if you'd like. And you never know, you might want to rebroadcast them. If you do, then please just credit us here at thisweek.org.uk. Let me know and we'll also credit you. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable election weekend as we find out what's happening on with the mayors. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.